Close our eyes and observe a moment of silence for prayer and meditation. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and our guests. Indeed, this is another day that the Lord has given us a chance to make a meaningful contribution towards the lives of His children, His people, including us. So, I'd like to welcome you to this meeting. I'd like to welcome the honorable members, welcome the delegation from a Human Science Research Council, but also the media present here and all other guests and the members of the community who decided to join us this morning. Well, we will be receiving a briefing from a Human Science Research Council. It is a briefing on the 2016 MTBPS, looking at this from the angle of the Human Science Research Council. I have no doubt that as we listen carefully, this briefing will further empower members, ensuring that members in their engagement with this very MTBPS and the relevant departments that will be called to come and appear before the committee, but also the broader community, as we will be participating in a public participation, which is one of our core mandates, so that as we engage from an informed position, but also we make a meaningful and constructive engagement. Well, the mandate of Human Science Research Council entails informing the effective formulation and monitoring of government policy, evaluating policy implementation, research-based data and fact-based research results. This is critical in the context of the MTBPS, given that an evidence-based policy-making agenda that is strongly linked to the decisions that we will make as this committee as we examine the government spending priorities for the next 3 years. It's actually not decisions, recommendations to the House. Well, these recommendations will significantly enhance quality budgeting. So ideally, government programs that fail to produce verifiable results should be curtailed, while truly effective programs should retain their budgets. We want to see visible impact as this committee representing Parliament and also as Parliament on the ground from the budgets that we approve as Parliament. The brief will assist the committee to robustly engage and assess the risks that can affect our development path to inclusive growth that will benefit everybody. Well, honorable members, indeed, as Parliament, we need to fully consider all possible policy options on how best to use the limited resources that we have, especially in ensuring that the budget is truly responsive to the people's needs. This is critical to achieve the 13 developmental goals contained in the NDP. So, Welcome once more. Let's have robust and fruitful engagement as we work towards radically transforming our country. I thank you. Shall we then move on to the next item, which is apologies? Are there any apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson. We have one apology from Mr. Sheikh Imam, who's attending the SADC conference.
Chair, may I take leave at 20 past 11, doctor's appointment, and then there's a...
I'm sorry, Whip, I can't hear you. You can raise your voice.
May I take leave at 20 past 11.
Okay.
I have a doctor's appointment.
Okay, doctor's appointment.
And at 12:30, there's another meeting that I need to attend.
All right. Honourable Member Shopestole.
Morning, Chairperson. Morning, everybody. The apology for Honorable Sinukwanyana. She's attending the Health Committee.
For Honorable Member Sinukwanyana. Honorable Members, these are the apologies. I would like to find out from the members if they accept the apologies. Do we accept the apologies? Honorable Member Manana.
Yes, Chairperson, accept the apology.
Acceptance of the meet of the apologies. Any seconder? Thank you very much. Seconded by Honourable Member Shopestole. Well, this is the day that we've been waiting for. Looking forward to learning more from Human Research. I'm sorry, Human Science Research Council. So I will now hand over to the head of the delegation, or maybe we should do the introductions. How is that? You happy? Satisfied? Members, we'll do the introductions. I am Pinky Possum, the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Appropriations. This side?
I'm Daba Gwabaza, whip of the committee.
Thank you very much.
I'm Swangida Manana, member of the committee.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm Malcolm Figg, member of the committee.
Thank you, Honourable Member Figg.
Alan McLaughlin, member of the committee.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
I'm Sheila Shopesitole, member of this committee.
Thank you, Honourable Member. At the back.
Morning, Chair. My apologies for being late. I'm Natasha Langweni, a member of this committee.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
Morning. My name is Seliwe Madlopa, member of the committee.
Well, thank you very much. We now know the honourable members who are attending this meeting. I will hand over to HSRC to introduce your delegation, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Crane Sodin, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the HSRC. I'd like to introduce my colleagues who are here to support us. On my immediate left is Dr. Vijay Reddy, and she's the Executive Director of Education and Skills Development. Sitting next to her is Professor Ivan Turok, and he's the Executive Director of Economic Performance and Development. Alongside of him in the middle here is Professor Nanya Bola-Muller, and she's the Executive Director of Democracy Governance and Service Delivery. Second last is Dr. Heidi, what's the professor actually, Heidi van Rooyen? She's our Executive Director for Human and Social Development. And lastly is Professor Labadarius Dimitri, and he's head of our program called Population Health, Health Systems and Innovation, and we're being supported by our colleague here, Mr. Noor Fakir. So, Chair, as you hear, these are all development specialists. Development specialists or innovation specialists. And so this is not the full slate of our executive directors, but they are the colleagues who have been asked by us to respond and comment on the on the budget statement. So what we are going to do, Madam Chair, is I will briefly do an introduction, make a few remarks, and I will then sequentially hand over to my colleagues thereafter. I want to say, just by way of getting the presentation going, that the work that we are going to present, a lot of it comes out of the research that we do. So we are a research council. We're an entity supported largely by a parliamentary grant. So up to 50% of our income comes from Parliament. And it is our mandate to do human sciences, human behavior-based research, which can inform public policy. And so it's a really important opportunity for us here to come to talk to these public policy issues, such as this budget statement, on the basis of the work we do. So very, very quickly, Chair, this first slide, and sorry, I must make apology. There are a few more slides in your pack than the ones that we initially sent you. Not many, so we're not going to deviate much from what we've done, but we've put in a few more slides on health and the capable state. So what we're going to do in this presentation is essentially talk to the brief that was given us by the Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Committee said, come to talk to us about these key issues which are listed in the slide. Accelerating economic growth, infrastructure, investment, job creation, education, capable and skilled public service and health. And we do that in the context of the way in which this budget policy statement has been framed and developed, to say that the country is at a crossroads. What we'd like to do in making these comments is to give a sense of what this crossroads actually is, and what the challenges are that we're confronted managing both our performance as a country in relation to this crossroads, but also to think about what the opportunities and the risks might be. Next slide, please. So the purpose of the budget policy statement is essentially to give us a sense of what the intention of government is for the next 3 years in terms of its revenue and in terms of its expenditure, taxes and spending over the next 3 years. The statement is as Madam Chair said, a set of recommendations. Its overarching goal, the statement itself, is to understand how the country can be stimulating its economic growth. The crossroads that the country finds itself in, and we'll be talking to this repeatedly, is that there are a number of critical features of the economic situation in which we find ourselves in that we need to be deeply aware of, which we need to understand absolutely clearly. The first one, and it's there in the budget policy statement, is that government borrowing, and it's quite a critical thing, has risen rapidly from 28% of GDP in 2008 to 47% now, and is rising. And that's the first reality. At this rate of borrowing puts us in a particularly vulnerable position. It has knock-on consequences. It's going to raise the rate of and the cost of borrowing elsewhere in the economy, and it puts pressure on an already heavy debt burden that we have. Thank you. Now, these decreased tax revenues, the income that we receive from our tax, has got fundamentally to do, and that's the second bullet point there that we have there, got fundamentally to do with the downturn in the economic situation in the around the globe, beginning with the financial crisis in 2009. So that what that financial crisis has done is perhaps a little later than it would have been the case elsewhere in the world, it's brought us to the point where the tax that we're able to generate is less than it had been before. And you see that in downturns in value-added tax, in VAT. VAT is down and personal income tax is down. And they're quite extraordinary things, Madam Chair. With those sources of revenue down, the country is in a quite a difficult a situation. The next slide makes the point there about our obligations. So how, with this decrease in the revenue that we have access to, and the increase in our national debt, we still have all of these obligations, which we have as part of the National Development Plan and the agenda of government. Critical in that National Development Plan, as you all know, is addressing poverty and inequality, finding ways of mitigating poverty and engaging with these conditions which lead to the exacerbation of the gaps between the rich and the poor. So those are by way of introductory remarks, colleagues, important for me to set the scene. Decline in revenues, increased debt. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Professor Turok.
Thanks very much. Just to now elaborate a little bit further on some of the detail. So this shows that basically the debt levels have roughly doubled over the last 8 years. And in fact, the biggest item in the increase in government spending has been the repayment of the debt, right, the biggest growth. So we'd rather spend it on health and education and other social priorities, we're having to spend it on interest payments, right? So the next slide shows the reasons for this. This is the drawn directly from the MTVPS, the decline in the growth rate of the country over this period. And they draw this interesting comparison between the average growth rate during the early 2000s of 4% with the later 2000s and early 2010s of 2%. So the average growth rate has halved, which has obviously had big consequences for tax raising and for our ability to spend. And this is the challenge. Now, those gray lines at the end are the kind of hope that if we get our act together, we can recharge, get growth going again. But I think this is where the big uncertainties lie. Can we turn around? Are we at the turning point? These green shoots of recovery, how do we nurture them and how do we water them and ensure that they turn into stronger growth is the key question. The context is pretty gloomy, to sum up. Growth rate this year expected to be only 0.5%. Remember that the NDP that the chair talked about a growth rate of 5.4%. So we're a long way below where we really want to be. The effect of slower growth has been to affect the fixed investment. We've seen a decline in fixed investment of 11% over the period 2008 to 2015. And again, it's contradictory to the NDP. NDP talked about the critical importance of more investment as the basis for stimulating and generating economic growth and development. Now, one of the interesting things about the analysis of the MTBBS is the argument that, you know, a key part of our problem is low confidence on the part of investors, reflecting partly instability in the country and within, indeed, the governing party. instability of all kinds is believed to be a major cause, right, as well as a consequence of high unemployment and poor economic performance. It's also now considered to be a cause of our problem. So this is quite a provocative statement on the part of the finance minister, reflecting the widespread anger, discontent, violent protests, with a knock-on effect for tax collection. So we are collecting less tax than we need to in order to meet the costs of our various social services. Some of the particular problems lying behind this shortfall in taxes are the growth in the wage bill, which has been faster than expected, the unexpected costs of our state entities, such as South African Airways, causing this tightrope, put it that way, between for the near term, as to government doesn't want to cut spending to such an extent that it damages growth, and chokes off these green shoots of recovery, and yet tax revenues have been falling. So where the balance lies, I think, is a critical issue in analysing this MTBBS between cutting spending and raising taxes, and the ultimate objective of not damaging growth, but actually strengthening growth. Okay, I think a key issue is around the type of spending. Now, maybe I'll come on to that later. What type of spending? Because different forms of government spending will have different economic impacts. So this just demonstrates, I think, a very positive record of the government in terms of the increase in public spending on much of this is around health, education, really important objectives. We've effectively doubled the government over the last 10 years, doubled per capita spending. Right, that's quite an impressive record and reflects relatively good economic performance over that period. Of course, there have been many jobs created in that period as well. But the problem has arisen that the spending and the revenue are now at odds or contradictory. That we've had actually, through the efforts of SARS, impressive record of, that's the black line on this graph, impressive record of revenue raising, despite slowing growth, as I showed before, despite the slowing growth of the economy, actually that SARS has done an incredibly impressive job in widening the tax net and recovering tax from people who weren't paying tax before, being very creative in raising revenues. But I think the sense is that that's kind of run out of steam, which is why we face this challenge of finding new sources of revenue in a context of very slow growth. So the implications, and this is a really important slide, implications of what the MTBBS is saying is that we need an extra $43 billion in higher taxes over the next 2 years. So where are we going to get these taxes? The MTBBS doesn't tell us where we're going to raise this extra taxes. That's need to wait for the February budget. But it's putting a figure on it, which is quite important, and that's quite a high figure. It's not an astronomical figure, but it's quite a high figure historically. It's higher than was anticipated in February, and most commentators are saying this is realistic. And then the other side of it is the cuts in spending. So the MTBBS is saying $26 billion over the next 2 years. Now, it's the cuts in spending growth, okay, so it's not saying we cut absolutely, but it's saying slowing the rate of growth in public spending, right? And the ways in which it's saying we do that is through public entities, the state entities I mentioned, the large conditional grants like the Urban Settlements Development Grant. National departments will have to take a cut in their growth. Provincial equitable share, housing, transport, water. This will require, in the words of the MTBS, discipline, sacrifice, collective effort. So it's not mincing its words, saying it's quite a tough time ahead for the next couple of years. And this is showing where the balance of sacrifices are going to have to be made. And interestingly, I think the one interesting thing we take about this is, does this correspond with the objective of stimulating growth? The challenge when you're pruning expenditure is, who takes the pain? We see post-school education and training, we'll hear more about that in a second, as a big increase. The first one I mentioned already, the debt servicing costs just to pay for this higher debt. Social protection is safeguarded. Health is relatively safeguarded. Economic affairs are taking a hit. Agriculture is taking a hit. General public services. So that may be a source, something to discuss. But over the last 5 years, or between 2006 and 2011, there was a very big increase in public employment. We see this in municipalities, in the provinces, in central government, 20% growth in public sector jobs, corresponding with the increased spending. So this is now expected and planned and required to actually fall slightly, 25,000. It's a modest fall, and it's not through, you know, compulsory redundancies. It's through attrition is the word, which is not filling posts when they become vacant. It's through being more careful about new employment. Who's going to be affected most? The MTBBS isn't very clear about that. Is it going to be frontline staff, nurses, teachers, or backroom administrators? I think that would be an important issue to question government about it. Obviously, one is more important than the other. The reductions in free basic services, there's some talk about that, slowing down the extension of electricity and water in rural areas is mentioned. So some of these are going to be difficult politically. Tougher cost-saving measures. So the Treasury is going to regulate these, not just ask public entities to contain their costs, but actually to impose regulations, and we see some of that. In fact, HSRC is affected by those regulations as well, to try and prune the spending on hotels and so on, entertainment and consultants. The growth in university funding is the biggest change. We'll hear more about that as a result of student protests. Treasury responded very positively. And some increase in health services and social protection to cover the cost of medicines and that kind of thing. No growth in infrastructure investment. So in the past, infrastructure has been seen as the key means of stimulating growth. Now there's acknowledgement for the next 2 years that's going to be very difficult. This is just to put a graph on those staffing, increased public sector employment. We see that the total number is stable with a slight decline over the next couple of years. It's really, we are in a different situation, right? Looking forward from what we've been in for the last decade in terms of public sector employment. It really is quite a turning point. The vision, my last two slides, the vision for the future. The MTBUS does offer some thoughts about, you know, how do we get things, how do we shift the path we're on. So it calls for concerted action to inspire confidence and boost inclusive economic growth. So this is the kind of response to the view of the problem being instability and low confidence, is we have to pull together. We're all in this together. It's up to us, the minister kept saying, as you heard many times. So it assumes that the economic cycle has reached the bottom and that over the next year or so we'll back up to 2%. So that assumption is, I think, really important to question. What are the conditions required to really turn our stagnant position around and to inject some momentum into the economy? How do we get this confidence? How do we pull together? If we don't do that, I think the scenario is pretty negative. This fiscal cliff that other people have talked about, you know, will result in very severe cuts. The cuts at the moment are planned in relation to slower growth in spending, but if we don't turn the thing around, then I think we're facing a much more bleak scenario that we really have to try and avoid as far as possible. And the MTBUS is pretty frank about that, I think. It's quite a wake-up call to people about where we are. A holistic approach, a collective approach, across government, business and labour, more collaboration, trying to see each other, find each other, to find common ground, to work together and identify priorities and identify actions that can generate investment and stimulate confidence and spending. But actually, if one is very critical of the statement, it's hard to see much focus. Okay, there's this nice words, strong words, and quotations from all sorts of leaders historically. But you know, where is the focus of this agenda? I think we would have some questions about that. What exactly is the critical element that government can focus on in order to drive and stimulate change? Is it around reform? Of course, these things are very controversial. Different interests will advocate different points of focus. Some people are asking for privatization of state entities to release resources. Others are arguing for reform of the labor market. Others are saying relax the mining constraints to stimulate investment in mining. The final point I want to make is one possibility that is alluded to in the budget, MTBPS, is around the city's agenda. And I think it could actually make more of this, because I think there are many of our difficulties are very apparent in our cities in terms of the logjam of government not being coherent, government not got its act together around the urban agenda, around the potential to raise private investment, around the long-term productivity benefits from investment in our cities, getting our cities to function well, in terms of the payback from public investment. This is where it's much easier to attract private investment in housing, in infrastructure, because our cities are places of considerable potential. So it seems to me that many of the arguments of the MTBBS about coordination of government, public-private partnerships, about inclusive growth, they really come home to root when it comes to getting our cities to function better. And I think one could make a case for saying that a strong push to get our cities working better, to build more housing for our people who are moving to cities, to provide all sorts of services, not just hard infrastructure, but also things like insurance and loans to people who want to start up businesses because there are no jobs. There is a very strong case for a sort of focused push, maybe even an Operation Pakisa for our cities to get, as I say, break through the logjam, to build partnerships and confidence, and to enable private sector and households to invest to stimulate the growth and diversification of the economy of our cities. It's not at the expense of rural areas, because the two are closely interdependent, but it is one possibility, I think, that just to put it on the table for discussion. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to make a presentation to this committee. I'm going to speak about education, and I think the letter talked about allocative efficiencies with regard to different parts. And I tried to interpret what is it that I could draw from the research that we're doing in the HSRC and share that with you. So the focus of the presentation, I mean, we know about education, we know the issues in education, and I would like to share some information related to our research and to try to texture and nuance the debate a little bit more. And so it's asking the questions around the allocative efficiencies. And I need to go up. Again, and these are things for just repeating and contextualizing, when education and skills is very important for personal, social, and economic growth. And if we're looking in terms of the economy, jobs, we need skilled people, we need people with high levels of education. And it is the number one health and education are the two top priorities in the country. So from a political perspective, from a commitment perspective, everybody is committed to education. And yet, we're not experiencing the kinds of changes that we would like to see, and we see it as a major logjam. Now, the budget speech focuses rightly so on the access, and particularly so in terms of the various movements and the increase in allocation to the education budget. I think as part of engaging about education, I'd like to push the debate a little bit more on the issues of progression, success, and labor market destinations, and therefore ask the bigger questions, and as one looks to education in the future, that we extend the framework of our engagements with this. Of course, the education sector is big, and for the purposes of this presentation, I'm just going to focus on post-school sector, university, and TVET colleges, and that kind of information. Again, as contextualizing it, I've presented a slide there to look at various countries, and if one looks in terms of what is our expectation of what the education level for our population should look like. And looking at this slide, which draws on a number of OECD countries but also incorporates South Africa, we see that in 2012, the triangular bars, that South Africa is second from the left, and about 8 or 9% of our population between 25 and 64 years old have a tertiary education. In terms of the OECD definition, tertiary education is anybody who would have completed a grade 12 and needed grade 12 in order to access some sort of studies thereafter, and that study would have been at least 2 years in length. And just looking at a couple of countries as a point of departure, right next to us is Brazil, where 12% of the population are defined as tertiary. A little lower down, Chile and Mexico are higher, and Portugal, and of course the average, the OECD average, is around 20% of the population should have has a tertiary education. And right to the extreme right, we have countries like Russia, Canada, Japan, with high levels of tertiary education. And this is the kind of countries and the kind of profile that will also support industrial growth and development and societal growth. And so it kind of gives a sense of a target that we should aspire towards if we want to try and bring about the kinds of growth, although I acknowledge that education and skill is a necessary but not sufficient condition for growth, and job creation is another whole area. I also thought, just as a kind of, and again it's not a blame kind of game, but if we look at the efficiencies throughout the system, let's look at it in one page and to see and interrogate our own performance. Drawing on research that we did with Savas van der Berg from the University of Stellenbosch, where we followed through cohorts of people that finished matric in 2008 to draw this. And in terms of this, we tried to follow people to look at, if we look, if 100, here's the sort of takeaway point of this whole slide. If we start off with 100 people and we follow them, 60 people of that 100 will write matric. So we've lost 40 people along the way. Of that, 37 people will pass matric. And of those people that pass matric, 14 people come out with a bachelor's pass, which means access to universities, 12% with a diploma pass, which can also access TVET colleges. Of the 37 then, we find that 12 people access university. And not everybody goes directly from grade 12 into university. 9 go immediately, 30 go later. The bit of worrying figures that we have there, that, for example, in 2008, we had 112,000 people that achieve a bachelor's pass. 35% of that 112 don't go to university. I mean, they made, and off that, 13,000 come from the quintile 1, 2, and 3 schools. That means the no-fee-paying schools, the poorest area. And I want to keep making this point that we can't lose anybody along the way. I mean, it takes a lot for a kid from the quintile 1, 2, and 3 schools to achieve a bachelor's pass, and then to lose them, and they don't access university. So 12 access university. 6 people complete with some sort of university qualification, undergraduate diploma, within 6 years of matric. So they don't. So the completion rates take a long time, and we have six, and we have four people. Of that 100 that start, four people get a degree within 6 years after matric. So that's the profile, and it gives us on a one-pager the profile of how our students pass through schooling, the losses that we experience, and the successes that we experience. And it's within that debate that I'd like to, you know, talk about the respites and the other parts. And again, the message is, each time, and we often talk about the failures in the system, but I'd also like to talk about those that succeed but through other reasons may not be accessing other paths. And how then does the system facilitate that? And, of course, the funding is one aspect of the whole story. We also know from various literatures, including our own, and we've shown this, that the key constraint to post-school education, to the labor market successes, is the quality and competences from the schooling system. And again, looking at the picture in a little bit of a long-term way, from 2010 to 2014, these bars represent the number of people that would have completed with bachelor's passes. And it kind of comes around 100, on average, about 140,000 people a year. But having a bachelor's pass, and I'm particularly interested in skills for the economy, and we've completed a major project for the Department of Higher Education and Training called the Labor Market Intelligence Partnership, which looked at how to organize the post-school sector and key looking at skills for the economy. And one of the documents that we put onto your table, the green one, is a kind of summary document pulling together the findings from there. And if we then look at how many of those that passed the came out with bachelor's passes and then passed with 50% in matric mathematics, which allows access to the science, education, engineering and technology subjects, it works out to about 50,000 each year. So 50,000 people coming out of the schooling system would then have to go to become doctors and engineers and scientists and a whole range of activities, and we do know that science and mathematics they're very versatile, and people pick up the mathematics is a proxy for the kind of analytic skills that they would bring, and equally the percentages there. So the everything rests on getting our schooling system right, and again I'm repeating things that we already know. Again, just to as a slight advertorial, on the 29th of October with the Department of Basic Education, we'll be releasing the results of how South Africa performed in an international maths and science study, the TIMSS study, and to see whether as a system we've improved or dropped. So Minister Motshekga will report on those kinds of things, but the 29th is that. Now, again, looking at our post-school system and even looking at our schooling, we've done relatively well with respect to access. School participation rates are very high. Even the universities, and looking in terms of trend and time, we've improved the access to the universities. And in 2014, the university sector was sitting, it was about 1.1 million students. And that has shown slow increase of 2.1% from 2010. If we look at the technical vocational education and training sector, we've seen massive expansions between 2010 to 2014. In 2009, and I think Minister Nzimande came in around that time, there were about 350,000 people in the TVET sector, and it kind of doubled to 2014, and the latest trends are the numbers are dropping, and I think this year the Department of Higher Education and Training is concerned, sitting at 580,000. And people from the TVET sector are critical for, and those skills, if your middle or intermediate skills, are critical for the economy. And of course, one of the big concerns has been that the throughput has not been good, the success rates has not been good. And on the right-hand side, we see in 2014, 185,000 completed from the university sector. These were both degrees and diplomas. So it gives us a sense of how people can then access to the labor market. But if we look at the TVET sector, and of course, 21,000 completed with a National College Vocational. That's an equivalent to a matric. the success rate there is just about 10%. So many people are accessing, 60% of the TVET sector are people that are doing qualifications less than grade 12. 40% are looking at tertiary qualifications. And we have 57,000 people that graduated with the NATED 6 qualification. And so if we look overall in terms of completion or success rates, I'm not going to go through every part of the slides for there. But each of the figures, and these come from various bits of research, 25% in the universities that go there. And one of the big concerns, all of it's a concern, but a bigger concern is that 5% for engineering diplomas, and these would be people that go to universities of technology, and you know, you're supposed to be doing the more applied to take their places, but their success rates are very, very low. If we look at the TVET colleges, again, the NCV, as I said, the qualification is equivalent to matric. And how low, and generally what happens with those NCV people, they finish matric and they go backwards to get the more applied qualification. We also know that the measures for the TVET sector are not very good. Again, this gives a sense of the type of qualifications that come out, the kinds of skills and competences for our economy. On the left-hand side, we have just around 6,000 or 7,000 people on computer and informatics, and that's a key growth area, and so we have vast numbers of vacancies in that area. Through the Funza Lukshaka bursaries, we have 17,000 people that graduated for teaching. And again, our engineering qualifications, our science qualifications, yet we have very high numbers in terms of the business science. So as we look at our outputs, we also need to see how do we shift in terms of university sector and the type of qualifications. And one of the recommendations we've made is that at the moment, enrollments is 30% science, engineering, and technology, 30% business, and 40% humanities. And our recommendation has been that we need to increase enrollments in the SET area to 35% and perhaps drop the humanities because of the kind of skills base to get into the labor market. So, yeah, so that is it. An interesting part is to actually look at where do people that acquire qualifications, where do they work? We found that in the whole labor market, there are 3 million people with a tertiary qualification. 1.2 million with degrees in the whole labor market, and 1.8 million with diplomas. Of the 1.2 million people with degrees, 50% work in community and social services. That means in the government services. The good news is that most 93% that qualify in health sciences or education move into that sector. But they're not moving into other sectors. It could be the work conditions are better, and it does mean, and then you have 25% working in the financial services. So three-quarters of all graduates are only in two sectors. A major concern about how do we get the conditions of service in other sectors better. On the right-hand side, sorry, the word that's missing there, 118,000, there are 118,000 engineering degrees. We thought, let's just focus on the engineers, those that qualify as engineers, and where do they go? And again, one-third of them work in the financial services and not in the engineering sector itself. So we graduate people, and so the question we also have to ask, how do we make conditions of work attractive so they want to go into those sectors? Manufacturing sector, and that's the sector that we're looking at in terms of expansion for job creation, for growth of the economy, but only a quarter of our engineers work in that sector. So, again, as I said, it's just trying to nuance the picture about education a bit more, about where they also go to. And we've given, as I said, quite a bit of information. We have other information that if you'd require. And so what's the kind of concluding comments on education? And I wrote this last week, but this morning I was thinking, you know, what kind of... It's almost like we are improving, but it's almost like a trickle-down effect, little bits. And somehow I don't know what, but we need to do something that increases that pace of change. That must be accelerated because
if this trickles down, it's going to take a very long time for us to have the kind of educational profile that we want and to grow the economy and to get jobs, etc. And I'm not going to read the rest of it, I'll just go through the last point, but to say I think the overall kind of point is there's improvement, but it has to, something has got to catalyze the system to accelerate much more. And the last point, perhaps, because it feeds directly into the statements of the policy statements, that there's an additional 4.5 million billion to NISFAS, and of course, again, as we read the literature, we need to make NISFAS work better and to be more effective. But that will, in order to get where do you get that 4.5 million, will require top slicing from other departments. Not Department of Science and Technology, where we get our budgets from, please. Because research is very important. So the top slicing from the departments, and how then do we sustain that? And of course, if we look at, if we have more graduates, they can contribute to the economy. And I know the question is often asked, how do you recoup NISFAS bursaries? 50% are in government services. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, colleagues, I will speak briefly on health. And I think one of the key elements of the minister's speech is a question, really, how to increase equal access to healthcare. And that is not just an appropriate question. It's a significant question in relation to Section 27 of the Constitution. It's also a significant question because it can only be improved by universal health coverage, which is really our only means. We hope we will be successful to reduce inequalities of access in health. How we go about it, of course, is extremely important. Equally important is that despite the consolidated government increase of 7.6% accounting for inflations.
Prof, if I may interrupt you, could you please use your mic?
I am using my mic.
You must press it.
It is on. Oh, yeah. Can I be heard? Can you hear me? Maybe I can get this one. I will try and increase the sound. Can you hear me now? So I was saying, can you hear me? I just don't want to go too near now. Thank you. There is commitment because there is additional allocation that has been given for post-school education, health services, and social protection. And that actually is of fundamental importance because with the difficulties that are coming as a result of the economic slowdown, we need to maintain a protection or a floor of protection of the poor to the extent that this increase in budget will achieve. But it is also important because as a country, we are faced with an increasing burden of disease, because we are not looking after ourselves as well as we should. And this burden of disease increase goes pari passu with increased costs in healthcare, which is really additionally important because ill health is as common, if not more common, among the poor than it is with well-resourced people. And the increasing burden of disease is something that is going to bankrupt many countries, including South Africa, because we are talking, or at least the health sector of it, we are talking about the non-communicable diseases, the diabetes, the obesity, the hypertension, and so forth. So what I have done in the next slide to give you an impression, this is the work of the HSRC that was published in The Lancet last month, and it shows a group of people 25 to 39 years. And these are the results of 12 sub-Saharan countries in sub-Saharan Africa, all the data pulled together to see the patterns that emerge. There is the red arrow there that indicates South Africa. And you can see when it comes to men, we are third worst in terms of overweight and obesity. And when it comes to women, the red, well, we're top of the league. Now, if that is at 25 to 39 years of age, and when you go on to 55 plus years of age, we maintain the worst position or second worst position in the league, together with the Seychelles. So this is something that we have to take care of sooner rather than later. What is also important in relation to health costs, next slide, this is comorbidity. In simple terms, comorbidity means to have more than one disease, diabetes and hypertension, for instance, or diabetes, you can have the full catastrophe, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and heart disease, yeah? So this is what comorbidity means. You can see very clearly, I don't have to stay on that slide much longer, that African males and females, sorry, can we go back? No, thank you. African males and females are the ones with the highest percentages or the highest prevalence of comorbidity. Another thing that actually adds to costs. It's not just one medicine, it's a lot of medicines. And it's not just one complication, it's a lot of complications. So we are faced with a very difficult situation. So the pace of the next slide, in terms of the pace of transformation, the National Health Insurance and the regulatory reforms that are being proposed are actually fundamental to address budgetary provisions for the National Health Insurance. But secondly, it attains for us the elusive at times, but very much sought after inclusive development, as the majority of the people get coverage or will get coverage and social protection. And it is appropriate for the medium term to actually afford further growth in protection services, including access to health, and hopefully promote inclusivity. And the next slide, in terms of spending priorities, well, you know, it is extremely significant that general practitioners, the contracting of general practitioners is being given, shall I say, a second and hopefully accelerated chance in making the necessary contribution to improve health care. Because, you know, the state cannot do it alone. There are no resources in the state that can do it alone, achieve primary health care for all equally at primary health care level. And apart from that, it is a time that the healthcare system is experiencing serious shortages of personnel at various levels, particularly at the GP levels willing to join the healthcare, the public healthcare. And of course, ill health begins in childhood. I prefer to make it that, express it that way, rather than saying good health is determined in childhood. Ill health begins in childhood. So it is very pleasing to see that there is improvements and budgets for the school health program, because that's where NCDs begin. And unless we are successful there, we will be missing the boat, apart from other considerations. So these are the few conclusion, key points in the budget for health. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the honor of being here as part of the HSRC team to speak to you. I'm part of a program called Governance, Democracy, and Service Delivery. So I'll be talking about the issue of capable and skilled public service. But of course, related to this is how our people feel about the delivery of services, the levels of satisfaction and the perceptions around the delivery of services and around the capability of the public service sector. First of all, you can see in the figure illustrated here the increase in national and provincial employee headcount, very steep from 2007 to 2012, and then it's remained relatively constant. Now the question would be, are numbers solving the problem here? I know that it's clear that there has been job opportunities created, which is good for the country, but simultaneously, are the people who are being appointed skilled and capable enough to deliver the services that the South African public require? Before I move on to the next slide, we have in the Human Sciences Research Council in my program something called the South African Social Attitude Survey. And the survey is part of the International Social Satisfaction Survey. And there was a study done in 2014 where the 34 countries where the survey is conducted, questions were asked around the how do you feel about the quality of the services that you receive and how do you feel about how you are served. South Africa fared relatively well, 13 out of the 34 countries, and interestingly enough, 48% satisfied with the way that they are served, and 48% dissatisfied, and the rest unsure or unable to answer the question. The second issue of concern is how widespread do you think corruption is in the public service in South Africa? Out of the 34 countries, South Africa is fifth from the bottom. Venezuela is right at the bottom, then Croatia, Lithuania, Russia, and South Africa, where 56% of our population believe that a lot of the public service are corrupt. Okay, then going on to issues around satisfaction with the economy. How satisfied are you with the general economic situation in South Africa at present? There you can see satisfaction with the general economic situation from 2007 to 2015, and there's quite a significant difference in the figures between 2014 and 2015. Generally speaking, general economic satisfaction has declined from 43% in 2007 to 25% in 2015. And of course, this is based although we're talking about the general economy, this is based on people's individual perceptions, how things are affecting their lives as individuals and households. Views on the economy tend to reflect the objective macroeconomic performance indicators, so that you can see there that there is a relative reflection in the slide next to the bar chart. Satisfaction with key areas of social spending. The CESAS series examines trends in satisfaction with key areas of government performance. And those modules are included in every year. And we survey at least 7,000 individuals in all provinces. It's a cross-sectional survey that has taken place since 2003. There is considerable satisfaction with social grants, an average of 70 to 75% in 2015. So it appears that SASSA is doing its work well. There were a lot of concerns around this initially, but the satisfaction with social grants is high. There is, interestingly, broad contentment with education, and we're not sure about why this is, but modest signs of slippage, average of 67% down to 62% in 2015. Around half are satisfied with access to healthcare. So this is improving, as you can see. There's a little bit of a wobble there in that slide, but there is generally an increase in satisfaction with healthcare, average being 52 and 57 in 2015. The big success story, as we all know, is the HIV and AIDS treatment. Satisfaction has risen from 22% in 2003 to 55% in 2015. The biggest concerns that South Africans have, job creation, 9% satisfied on average, 8% in 2015. It's really low. Crime reduction, something we don't talk about much. An average of 21%, 20% in 2015. Very, very low levels of satisfaction with regards to crime reduction. And then low-cost housing, also low levels of satisfaction, an average of 33%, 39% in 2015. So those are the three main concerns that we have found through the South African Social Attitudes Survey. Generally, other levels of social spending are found to be satisfactory. Making ends meet. Sometimes people find that their income does not quite cover their living costs. In the 12 months, has this happened to you? And this basically, again, is based on experiences of individuals and households and includes how effective services are rendered to them. Financial literacy work was commissioned by the Financial Services Board. On average, 44% reported inability to cover living expenses. And it has risen to 48% in 2015. Those with low living standards struggle more to make ends meet, which is obvious. But a sizable share of those with medium and high level standards also battle. So 53% of people with minimum living standards are battling to make ends meet in South Africa. And 34% of people with high living standards also battle. So the bar graph gives you an indication of how much people are battling, and having to meet ends and finding it excessively difficult to do so. Then lastly, the minister mentioned energy quite frequently in his speech. So we thought we would just give you some idea of South Africans' perceptions around future energy preferences. Which of the following would South Africans' main priority be in order to meet future energy needs? Domestic energy attitudes and behavioral work was commissioned by the Department of Energy. Concern for cheap prices dominates energy preferences across the board. Renewable energy is preferred over non-renewable sources and nuclear energy. And similar findings across different living standard levels, but there's greater concern with pricing amongst poorer adults, obviously, and a stronger demand for renewables amongst those who are better off. But generally speaking, the concern across the board is cost and the various options were provided there. And it is clear that in the first instance, it does not matter as long as it is the cheapest option. And secondly, solar, wind, or water renewables were preferred. The issue of damage to the environment was also high on the list of concerns.
Thank you very much, Chair. So we'll just rapidly go through these last few slides. So these are concluding remarks. The first point to make there is that the top two drivers of poverty in the country are unemployment and limited years of schooling. And I hope that remarks that we my colleagues have made have helped to make that clear. That second bullet there, colleagues, is about this increase in unemployment from 2011 to 2016, from 40% to 52%. Those kinds of shifts are really of great concern, and they raise for us emphatically the importance of increasing our investments in employment. Now, we want to say, as we've been trying to go through this analysis here, that in doing and effecting a response like that, we're confronted here with these questions of lower tax revenues. Lower tax revenues, both, as I said, in terms of the VAT and also in personal income tax. Thanks. And Ivan spoke about this. So government has predicted a revised lower annual growth of 0.4% for the 2016-2017 period. The point to make about that is that that growth rate is inadequate to deal with the policy objectives that we are constructing for ourselves. Next one, please. It's repeating this last slide. Repeats the comments which Ivan was making about us having to tighten our belts and to reprioritize in terms of these demands that we are having to attend to, including financing fee-free higher education and acknowledging the dangers that are going to accompany having to make these responses and shifts in our allocations. The last point that we want to make here is simply to say that it's important to acknowledge the commitments that this medium-term budget policy statement continues to make. It continues to commit itself, and that's the last point, to social services, economic services, protection services, post-school education, housing development, municipal infrastructure, health, basic education, and job creation. And that's the encouraging feature of this policy statement. With that, Chair, thank you very much for listening to us, and be very happy to take any comments and questions that you might have.
Well, Professor, I would like to thank you for the elaborate presentation, which I want to believe that it has assisted us to gain deeper insight into your medium-term budget and the challenges that we are confronted with. So, honorable members, I will now open for a discussion. Let's reflect on this presentation and engage or interrogate the presentation. Over to the honorable members. Honorable member Dr. Madlope. Any other speaker? Can I take five and then? Honorable Dr. Fick, Honorable Ms. Ntlang Ngweni, and the Honorable Member Manana, Honorable Member Ndongeni. Thank you so much for reminding me. But Honorable Mr. McLaughlin, and then the last one on this one, Honorable Member Sheila, all right, please in that order. Shall we then intervene? Let's have three questions, né, per member, and we will give, when there's a need, we'll give members another chance, you know, for a second bite, a follow-up questions, and second bite. Okay. I am advised that it will be better of that I start with Mr. Gcobaza because he has indicated that he would like to leave at 11 so that we also benefit in terms of his input. And thereafter, it will be Dr. Madlope, and then we follow the order of hands. Okay. Over to you, Honourable Member Gcobaza.
I forget these things. They are not available in my rural village, you see. we shout across the hall if we speak to each other. Just on the first issue around the proposed VAT increase. It's not clear whether it's going to be a blanket increase is suggested or it's an increase that is targeted at selected items. I wonder what would be your take on that. How do you interpret what the minister is suggesting, and to what extent is this likely to affect largely those that are who can't make ends meet? The focus on economic strategy that you made reference to, the one observation that I make is that you there isn't any reference in your input to the ocean economy, which is said to have the possibility of adding about 177 billion rand to the GDP. What's your take on that? Has that taken off the ground, or is it still at a conceptual stage? Because I imagine that would if an acceleration was done in its implementation, it would really begin to change the unemployment situation in the country. Perhaps part of the challenge, and perhaps if you would comment on that, part of the challenge is that not too many of us probably have every detail about what it means, and therefore would find it difficult to enter into that space and begin to be active, especially those who are the youth who should really be entering into this space. So that for me is a bit of some kind of an oversight on your part. But let me just refer to slide 23 as well, because I made a note about that. Where is this? I'm sorry, Chairperson. I think it was something else. But that's the issue I wanted to raise. Your take on the issue of the ocean economy. Lastly, Chairperson, on slide 30 on housing. I mean, there's been a lot of houses built, some 3 million or so, but still people are not satisfied. Is it in your research, is it in terms of quality, is it in terms of access, or both? And perhaps the third area would be simply that people don't quite appreciate what these RDP houses mean to them. They're free, the land is free, you can probably do a lot more to the basic unit than that, and because of that lack of understanding, therefore people would express the dissatisfaction. If you explain what exactly were the reasons for this, in spite of so many houses being built, especially for poor people. It could just as well be that those who need them most have not accessed them, and those who need them less have accessed them. It could be just as well that, if you could explain.
Thank you so much, Honorable Member Gcwabasa. We will now call upon Honorable Member...
suggesting if they could respond to Honorable Gcwabasa so that he goes away.
Agreed. There's consensus. All right. Prof, and I think in all fairness, so that if he's got follow-up questions, he can then make those follow-up questions. Thank you.
I'll deal with the VAT and the ocean economy touch on, and my colleague might also want to say something about the ocean economy and the housing question. So there's been a lot of discussion in the media about the VAT increase, but as far as I'm aware, the minister has not yet said much about that. That will have to wait until February. My view is that it will probably be it's an attractive source of tax raising for government, because it brings in a lot. If you raise VAT from 14 to 15, it brings in a lot of tax revenue. So I think it is probably a target and very much in the sights of Treasury. I suspect that they will, if they introduce it, they will introduce it with some exclusions of basic essential goods like foodstuffs and so on, to try and minimize the impact. But there's no doubt that increasing VAT will hit the poor hardest, because you know, they spend a bigger proportion of their income, and therefore VAT is generally considered not a progressive tax, but a regressive tax. So it will be very controversial. but as I say, quite attractive because it brings in a lot of money. So as far as I'm aware, no decisions have been made, and it's a bit premature to speculate about that. On the ocean economy, there was the Pakisa on the ocean economy. My sense is things are happening around some of the ports. There's been some new investment in Etequini, for example. Oil and gas, things are happening. Saldana, there's been new investment there, special economic zone set up. So there have been a number of initiatives that have followed it, but probably not delivering it to its potential. So I think it has potential. It's not a panacea for all our unemployment problems, of course, but ocean economy is certainly something we should be taking very seriously. And I think maybe a review of the Pakisa might be timely to say, you know, is it delivering to its potential? What are the continuing blockages that are stopping it from happening? On the final point to tackle about the housing issue, I suspect that it's a combination of factors that explain the dissatisfaction. One would be those who don't have a house, have been promised a house, see the constitution guaranteed them a right to housing, so they are frustrated that it's taking time. In fact, the backlog has been growing slowly rather than declining, right, because of the population increase. I personally don't think it's a sensible policy to guarantee everybody a free house. I just don't think it's affordable, certainly not now. But also some of those who have been given housing are dissatisfied because the quality, we know there have been problems with the quality of the construction. We also know that many of the houses that have been built have been in a dormitory settlements on the edge of the cities and towns, and people are frustrated that the other facilities, you know, the schools, the jobs, the other health clinics and so on are not there or slow to come. And so it's that package, that integrated human settlements package that we haven't been delivering very effectively because it's been a preoccupation with numbers and focusing on the cheap land on the edge of the cities. We haven't created integrated places.
Thank you. The ocean's economy is essential, and I agree very much with that statement. Operation Pakisa, in fact, its Oceans Lab is the most successful one to date. It's the first one, admittedly. But it has been very successful in placing emphasis on ports and shipping, and in particular small ports. So that's a development that is taking place right now. Increased focus on oil and gas exploration and fishing and aquaculture, including small-scale fishing. So there have been jobs created in these areas, and also the issue that my colleague has stated around special economic zones. But much more can be done in this regard. I think that the issue that is always at the back of people's minds is sustainability, issues of the environment and sustainable growth. But I do know that our international relations focus has moved to the blue economy because of the fact that South Africa will be chair of the Indian Ocean Rim Association from 2017 to 2019, and South Africa is leading something called the Blue Economy Core Group within the Indian Ocean region, and it focuses on skills transfer and includes areas that perhaps Operation Pakisa hasn't focused on sufficiently, and that is tourism in the area of the Indian Ocean. So hopefully that is going to consolidate. Also, the African Union has adopted a maritime strategy, and the focus is on the role of women in the maritime sector. So there are lots of exciting opportunities to bring not only youth but also women into focus. So that is definitely an activity that the HSRC is involved in and very much would like to see grow. With regards to the housing issue, I agree with Dr. Turok, that it's a combination of factors. Some of the issues that have been raised by people during surveys was the slowness of the upgrading of informal settlements. People feel that there is a slow response from local government in terms of the provision of services and also the provision of housing, and that local government is not keeping up with the increased migration to cities. People are coming to cities looking for work, and when they come to the cities, they feel that they should have a house. You know, the Section 27 right to housing, although of course it's within available resources and progressive realization, it is still an expectation. And the point around the location of the housing is also very important, because as you're aware, our public transport system has much to be desired, and that interferes with access to work, to schools, to clinics, and so on.
Thank you. Just an additional point. Can everybody hear me? I must ask. Yeah. Just an additional point. Thank you for the opportunity. Just to enlarge a little bit the context of tax, I had a comment regarding the sugar tax in the second slide of health. And one would hope that will be help for health rather than for the general purpose of tax. And as you know, sugar tax is being debated intensively at the moment. But hopefully the wisdom will be that we can spend it on health, because not it's not owned by health, but the prevention interventions that we have to introduce are tremendously costly. Thank you.
No follow-up, Chair, except that I see that in social media there seems to be a growing support for sugar tax. The comment, Chairperson.
I cannot hear you, Chair.
It will be advantageous if it can be used for health.
Yes, and it seems that the recommendations of this committee go far, because in our May presentation we made a plea for the contracting of the GPs that serve the primary healthcare center the level, and one is so grateful and pleased to see that recommendation seems to have been taken up, so one is grateful for that, yeah.
Dr. Fick, you are covered. You're happy.
I'll use my own pen.
Okay, all right. No, that's fine. All right, then, thank you very much. Shall we then proceed then with the questions from the honorable members? Honorable member, Dr. Madlopa.
Thanks, honorable Chair. We welcome the presentation by Human Science Research Council. They always enlightened us on some of the issues that are challenging in the country. And can I just ask a question? I will start from where they ended, slide number 34. They indicated that the revised annual growth target of 0.4% is inadequate to deal with the policy objectives in budget program priorities targeting unemployment and poverty and inequality. I just want to check what is the view of Human Science Research Council, or what needs to be done in order to be adequate to deal with these policy objectives? What can be done? Because this one, the revised one, they think that it is inadequate. And then slide number 3, Chair. they also indicated the gross tech revenue decline. Is there any research that ACRC has conducted in relation to government revenue streams? If yes, what is your view in regard to this, or what needs to be done to improve the declining revenue collection streams, and what interventions to be put in place to ensure expenditure smoothing as well as fiscal consolidation in much faster pace without affecting social expenditure? And on page 11, Chair, when I'm about to land, we see this presentation, the diagram that is here, showing the debt service cost as well as the post-school education downwards. Given that debt service cost and post-education and training budget are the fastest growing expenditure items, what is the view of HCRC around the sustainability of South African budget for the next 3 years in those fast growing stream? And what are the implications for the fastest growing budget items like debt service cost, debt service cost and education and training in the current deficit? Because Chair said we must ask 3 questions, I will land. I wanted to ask in the education, but it's fine.
You get a second chance, but let's allow the other members to also intervene. Dr. Fick, thanks for your questions, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chair. I've got 3 questions, and each of them has an A and a B.
Come.
No, Chair, no. Okay.
All right, Dr. Fick, you may proceed.
Thank you. Chair, the issue that I've raised on many occasions is the point that has been emphasized here with regards to your debt as a percentage of GDP, where it was 28 and now it's 47. And, you know, people in the past have come here, analysts, and said, well, you know, it's not really a problem. And many, even the PBO, have said that it's not really a problem. Now that we are closing on 50%, it seems to become a problem. So I think we've failed here by letting it get to a problem figure, and now we are wanting to rectify it, which is very close to no turning back. It might be too late. So can I ask from the learned analysts here, what a reasonable figure would be of your debt to GDP, please? Where should we stop? Although we have very little control over it. Then I want to just touch on this VAT issue. I've just got something that I've been mulling over for a while now. You see, we are saying that we hear now that VAT is going to be increased, and well, it's a possibility. It's not final yet, but it's one of the possibilities. Now. And then we put a number of items and zero rate them. So, and that's in order to ensure that the poor people are not disadvantaged. But poor people are being disadvantaged in a way, because now what you're saying to poor people, you can only buy those things because you're poor. Should we not have a model whereby VAT or the richer people are charged VAT? Perhaps, and as I said, I haven't given this too much thought, by giving a poor person a VAT card, so that person won't pay the necessary VAT or VAT. However, in thinking about this thing, that VAT card should obviously have a limit on it, because you don't want a poor person being able to buy VAT or buy goods to the value of a few hundred thousand. So I was just thinking about this thing. As I said, I haven't given it too much thought. But because now the richer people and the middle class are also benefiting under zero-rated VAT, because they also eat brown bread. I also eat brown bread. Oh, sorry, I'm not middle class. I'm also poor. But what I'm saying is that you need to the poor people need to benefit from this fat. And I think maybe one needs to look at another model instead of using items and zero rating items. So I just would like to hear your thoughts on that. And then the last question, Honorable Chairperson, is regarding the fees. It's on slide number 16. Now, here again, and I hope I'm not raising an issue that is sensitive here, but again, I agree that the poor people must get free education, of course. But it can't be that every poor person benefits from no fees. I'm just saying, or lower fees. Surely there should be a condition attached. For example, it should probably be allocated on merit. What's your thoughts on that? On whether it should be allocated on merit? In other words, you can't say everybody, because we also heard in the presentation that the schooling system has failed us. Big time, that's an understatement. The schooling system is pathetic. And so what you have is, and that's why when I studied, my degree took me 3 years. I see now it's taking 6 years. So that's what's happening. I mean, there's the results, the research has shown that. So people are staying, they're studying longer because they're getting funded, and then also because the standards are low. So if anybody, those that are funded, I believe that they should be funded based on the merit, and maybe one should look at a benchmark again. Anybody over a certain, I know I'm going to get flack for this, but anybody over a certain percentage, maybe one should look at that, and I just would like to hear what your thoughts on that is. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thanks for your intervention, Dr. Afik. We'll now call upon Honorable Member Ntlangweni.
Thanks, Chair. It's quite interesting every time when the Human Science Research Council is here. Like, one can just listen to them the whole day. For me, Chair, I just hope that this report, as always, I always put emphasis on it, because a lot of work and money is going into this research that your councils are doing and commissions are doing. And one just hope that these reports get the light of day and ministers are implementing some of your recommendations that you are stating, so that we can move as a country. What was quite alarming in one of your reports that you were stating about the public service, that I think more than 50%, if I'm correct, that is the perspective of individuals out there, and that is how they see public servants, that they are corrupt and so forth. And one would have wanted, you know, that should be used to sort of change the shift of people's mind and stuff like that, so that they are more positive, and also the public servants in the sector to also sort of shift their views. This is what the people are thinking about you out there. What are your views in that, and you need to improve, and so forth. So I really think and really hope that these reports really are getting implemented, and it's also up to us as members of this committee to sort of push, so that some of your recommendations are really implemented. For me, I'm going to raise three now, Chair, and then I'll come back. But some of mine I have combined on two or three slides, so it will speak to two of your slides, and then I will just combine them in one question, which is on slide two, and then and again on slide seven. What I just like to find out, like, can the borrowing, the borrowing be attributed to the state entities that are not managed well, or the misconduct or financial misconduct in state entities? That's why we are, as a country, just now increasing on our borrowing. Can that be a factor, and then how does that influence on sort of your state entities, the management of state entities and the board of state entities, sort of try to help our economy to grow. So your views in light of the state entities and so forth. And then also we had the Public Service Commission yesterday here, and they made mention that some of the violent protests can be due to government not or government not implementing services or giving services to poor in people. So that can be, that normally people tend to have violent protests because they are not satisfied. What is your views around that? Have you done work around that? And to look at all of these protests that are happening, and also protests particularly also prior to election, and on how does those protests goes after election, so prior and post election, was work done in that regard? And then on slide 27, on the headcount that have increased, as well, on work done on skills in that particular arena, was work done in terms of to see if, since we have increased in employ on headcount, like, is the clerk qualified for that clerk position? If that accountant is qualified for that accountant position, and so forth. And then also just on the one of the schools, the primary schools, the doctor have said, I think on slide 19, on you have a situation where 100 learners are starting school and then only 4 are completing the degrees. Was this one just done within on public schools, or does it include also private schools as well? And then was it done in all provinces and so forth, so that one can look at a larger scale? So, and also, what is some of the factors? Can it be poverty or individuals falling out? You know, let me rather go and start and work than to complete this degree or so forth. So on that one, and then also on the health one is the last one. Chair, this is the last one. Sorry, Chair. The last one.
That's the sixth one.
So, serious, Chair. Now I'm breaking Shaky Mom's record.
Very last.
All right, the last one, Chair. The topic is so interesting, Chair. You just want to continue. And then also on the health one, yeah, on the obesity and so forth of our nation, was some work done in particularly, was it across South Africa work done in terms of obesity? Dr. Fick is laughing for me because I'm on a serious weight program here, a weight loss program here. So, like, in terms of obesity, and how do we do those paradigm shifts of people and takeouts and things like that? How do we shift them to eat more healthier and have a more healthier mindset? Because if you live more healthy, I have more energy. I have shed 5 kg in the past month, and I have more energy. So how do we shift that sort of mindset of communities? And also on the GP one as well, and we build state-of-the-art clinics, but is there staff for those state-of-the-art clinics? I remember, like, on Monday, my mom called me because I had to call the clinic. She was at a public clinic, in our township. And she called me and she said to me, look, I've been here since 8 o'clock and it's now 4 o'clock and I'm still here waiting for my medication. And she's diabetic. So, like, and she said to me, there's only one sister here at this clinic. So are we building all of these state-of-the-art clinics? Are there staff and GPs and nurses for these clinics? And how do we attract them to and make the market again attractable for them to sort of to come back into this area of work? Thanks, Chair.
Manana.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll try to stick to 3 questions as directed by the Chairperson. The first question is with regards to health problems. Prof, you indicated that we're in a serious problem here in South Africa. Communicable diseases, non-communicable diseases is really a problem. Maybe if you can share with us what went wrong, when, because these days you are seeing people are so obese and they are having the non-communicable disease, either hypertension, diabetes, and so on. But somewhere, somehow, there is something that we're not doing very well in South Africa, of which we need to correct it. It is a concern, and if you look at our male counterpart, you'll even think that, oh, this man, is it also pregnant or what? The manner in which they look like, Darren. We must start doing something. I'm also on the program of maintaining myself. Really, I'm taking this thing very serious because 2 of my sisters, they are diabetic already. I don't know whether is it hereditary or what, but that is why I've taken that caution decision that I need to do something about my own life. The second question is with regards to higher education. In the report that we were given by Treasurer, there was one issue that perturbed me with regards to the TVET, where they are saying out of 10 students who enter a TVET colleges, only one at the end of the day pass that course. It's a serious concern. And we are pumping a lot of money to this institution. What is your view with regards to that one? And what is the view of the commission with regards to the match of the output produced by institution of higher learning with the requirement for the labor market? I think I have asked 3. Thank you. I'll come back.
Honorable McDougle.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the HSRC for their presentation to us. I can just start by, on slide 1, right at the beginning, you speak about accelerating economic growth, this being an opportunity for enhanced state spending. Ever since I've sat in this committee, I've heard various people talk about accelerating economic growth. We hear the Minister of Finance, whoever he happens to be at the time, telling us the same thing every year in the budget. And so far we've failed miserably, because in the time I've sat here, our economic growth has actually gone down fairly dramatically. Now we're talking about the tough choices of increasing taxes. That's hardly going to accelerate economic growth. In fact, it's going to have the opposite effect, in my opinion. We're going to dampen things. Is there any sort of universally accepted model of accelerating economic growth? Is there something that's perceived to work in any given situation throughout the world that you're aware of? Is there some specific thing we can do instead of we seem to come out with all these platitudes every time, but no action seems to actually give the desired effect. We're spiraling downwards somehow. We've had the counter-cyclical model, and we've done this and we've done that. Nothing really does it. Do you have any ideas of what could really do it? What could actually get us into a situation where we can accelerate economic growth? Because obviously it's a desirable thing. We need it. That's the only thing we're going to really get to fix things, employ people, get more taxes in, etc. And just a question I had, that is there anything that we can actually, or that we know that can achieve it, but we just can't get doing that thing yet? We maybe need to take other steps before we can get there. Then on slide 2, my colleague also spoke about the government borrowing. I know the other economies in the world, America and Japan, that have borrowing rates of 150% of GDP, and it's not a problem to them because of the size of their economies. They can afford to do it. What I would like to know, and maybe you have the figures or maybe you can find them, if we talk from the percentage of the growth in borrowing, what is the percentage growth in the cost of servicing that borrowing? Is that escalating as well at a, let's say, an increased rate, because the more we borrow, the more expensive it gets, because it seems the more we borrow, the less creditworthiness we have. We've had a few sovereign ratings downgrades, which every time, I'm sure, knocks a few percentage points onto whatever it is we're paying back. And is there some kind of relationship between these two that means we're going to reach a point where we just can't afford to borrow? And where would that point likely to be? It's probably very much the same as my colleague asked, but just in different terms, perhaps. And then I'll limit it to 3 at the moment, so I'll keep it at 3. Main budget spending per capita in 2015 prices. This was, I think it was Professor Turok who said that the government has succeeded in at least increasing the spending. When we had a presentation yesterday from the Public Service Commission that gave us some indication of the percentage of achieving goals related to the percentage of spending. And in many instances, the two are terrible. People spend 100% of their budget and achieve 14% of their targets. So shouldn't we compare this as well with what you're achieving with the spending? It's sort of related to the schooling and the higher education. If we're spending money to put people through university, but 60% of them fall out of the bus before they get to graduate, is that wasteful expenditure? Should we be having a much closer screening process in the beginning to try and ascertain who's likely to come out of the university with a degree and who's likely to fall out? It's just a question I have there, to get more efficient spending. And do you have any sort of proposals around how we make things more efficient? And then lastly, if I may, Chair, just in the health presentation, that slide on comorbidity, just a simple question. Those percentages, are they a percentage of the total group or the specific racial groups that you split it into? I just wanted to get a clearer picture of what we were looking at there. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member McLaughlin. I will now call upon Honourable Member Shopes Tole.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thanks, HRC, for the good presentation. You know, you always make us understand what is going on around us. You make us to actually appreciate our situation much better. I'm just worried at the back of my mind, because when the minister was here, he actually said there is a problem of people not investing, the private sector. He says it's not here only. The whole globe, private sector is not investing. It's only governments that are actually investing. What is it? Because, you know, every time we are told that, you know, you must make the policies nice so that money must come into the country. You know, I remember very well in the a few years back, there was that narrative, and people, government changed to gear. And no, the investors went to China where they didn't do any such thing. So I don't know whether we have got a plan of maybe studying these private investors better so we can be able to convince them that it's important that they actually assist by investing in the area of job creation. Because, you know, I'm a backbencher. I earn very little. But every month I make sure that 5,000, I create a project for some young boys. So and I see it works because they're able to have money to carry to school. They buy themselves some caps and they're so happy. So I thought maybe those who are much more moneyed than myself, if they could just assist, it would help. The other thing that worried me is I read a report by the former president, President Mbeki, about capital flights. You know, monies that are leaving the country. Last week I had a discussion with another intellectual, because I like asking people to make me a little bit clever. He actually told me that, you see, what we have is peanuts. A lot of money is going out on the mining sector. People underprice their stocks when they send them outside. At times they say, no, we're sending out bananas, whereas it's platinum. Mm. You know, things like that. And these, unless we arrest those things, we will always suffer. Lastly, it's the education. You know, education. We spend a lot of money on education. But at the back of my mind, I sometimes ask myself: do the institutions of learning actually? Are they able to actually study the economy, the demands of the markets and the economy, so that they train people on relevant skills? Because I know for a fact, you know, when I'm home, weekends or holidays, a lot of youth come to me to say, you know, Mama, you must organize work for us. I say, bring your certificates. You know, they bring standard 10 and a lot of certificates, they call it the human resource. I don't know whether we can produce 10,000 human resource and no engineers and no carpenters and no plumbers. You know, I think we should have a discussion about what training are we spending the country's money, because if we continue like this, and I thought, because you know, those people who are full-time in the university and they are more learned than myself, who are just here because somebody said I must come to parliament, people who have got doctorates should be able to assist, to say, look, government, don't train too many human resource, train so many plumbers or so many electricians. Because those, on short courses, those courses are short, but we have got a lot of construction going on. People would get jobs. People would be helpful. In my area, if a tap, there's something wrong with a tap, it's a big problem. Because you can go the whole location. There's not one plumber. Not one. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member Shopes Tole. I will now call upon Honorable Member Ndongeni. Nokuzola, yes.
Oh, thanks, Chair. I didn't know I'm the last one. Thank you. Okay, Chair. Prof, on your presentation, you talk about the social protection. And then you said this is the opposite, given the need to maintain our social protection flow and protect the poor and vulnerable for further hardship association with the prevailing tough economic climate. Do you have a plan? What can we do to help those poor people, especially in rural areas? Let's not talk about us, because we are better than those who are in rural areas. What can we do to help them in this tough economic climate? The second one is on slide 7. On slide 7, you're talking about the growing concern over the wage bill. What are the mechanisms that the HRC can recommend to government to address the growing wage bill without negatively impacting on the frontline service delivery, at the same time being able to retain scarce and critical skills such as engineer, project managers, and other technical skills? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Member Ndongeni. With your permission, I would like to ask two questions. Prof, in slide 15, you indicate that there needs to be an emphasis on cities. Now, the 2016 MTBPS states that a key policy focus over the medium term is to promote urban planning reforms supported by public and private investment. This has been highlighted in the previous budgets as well. Now, what, in your assessment, are the main constraints in accelerating urban planning reforms? Where are the best practices that we can benchmark ourselves with in this regard? And how can funding be streamlined better to target our objectives for inclusive urban settings? Okay, my second question will be, in slide 24, most of our graduates do end up in the government services and also in the financial services. The MTSF speaks of the need to get small businesses to make a much larger contribution to growth. The NDP says that 90% of jobs will emanate from small businesses. How do we reconcile this? How do we grow the role of small business in the economy so that it can make this impact of 90% job creation? I will now hand over to Prof to provide responses to all the issues raised by the honorable members. And honorable members will be afforded an opportunity to make follow-up questions and, time allowing, introduce new questions.
Can I just, for our colleagues, organize the questions so that we can get through them efficiently, Chair?
Yes.
So the question of debt has come up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times and in different forms. And it's clearly an important issue which we need to be responding to. So Professor Turok will please, to these various dimensions around this question of debt, give us his insight. The question has come up about the levels of growth that are required in the economy and how we can get ourselves out of this trap that we find ourselves in at the moment. That question came up 3 times. There was then these the question, it came up about fees, and we will answer that question. The question of VAT came up twice, and I think we must answer that question clearly. And then these odd questions, I don't mean odd, strange, I mean single, around the state of our health, the state of our education, and I'll make sure, Chair, that we get to the... it may be that we may not be able to answer all of these questions. We will take the trouble to give you written replies if we are unable to answer them, and we'll do an assessment, Chair. But let me ask Professor Turok to kick us off, because the weight of the contribution is going to come from him. Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks very much. So these are very, very tough questions, okay? These are issues that are debated globally as well as within South Africa. So I'm not giving you, carte blanche, this is the solution. These are matters of debate and interpretation and very, very controversial among the experts too, okay? So on the debt issue, very, very appropriate questions. And the answer I'm going to give you is that in relation to the some levels of debt, one of the reasons people were saying it wasn't a problem in the past was because the perception was this was counter-cyclical, okay, so that we can sustain a reasonable level of debt, and that's a good thing to do in a recession, because you borrow at that time to try and prevent the recession continuing, to get the green shoots again, right? But if that recession doesn't turn around, if you don't turn around, then you're borrowing more to try and get it, and at some point it does become a big problem, and I think it's now become a big problem, as we see with that spending. Our top increase in spending is on debt servicing. That's not healthy, and that's not sustainable, right? So I think at the point, 50% of GDP in our situation, again, every country will have a different situation. My sense is that the Treasury is correct in saying it's now become, we're reaching the limit of it. When we head towards 50%, that's about as much as we can sustain without doing serious damage. Of course, other countries, Japan is always quoted as the example where it's over 100%, but it's a completely different situation in Japan. So I don't think it's apples and oranges. I think it's very hard, these international comparisons, to conclude that we can just follow Japan. On the issue of growth, of course that's the million-dollar question at the moment. How do we inject greater growth into the economy? So my answer is, firstly, it is hard. It is hard, and there isn't a single silver bullet, unfortunately. That's a response to some of the questions. There isn't a single thing you can switch, you can turn, and you get growth. So there are a number of things I'll say. The first one is, I think across the government, we need, and across society, to prioritize the need for economic growth and development more consistently. We still don't recognize this as a number one priority of the country. Job-intensive growth, inclusive growth, the minister talks about. As a society, we have to prioritize that. That means some things like recognizing, I'm glad you asked the chair the question about enterprise at the end. Only it came at the end. We don't respect and recognize small business sufficiently and make life easier for small businesses. There is a lot of red tape around starting and growing a business. And so we need to recognize as a society that enterprise is critical to our success. People are taking risks. We need to respect that. And we need different forms of enterprise, social enterprise as well as individual private enterprise. So we've got to promote enterprise, I think it seems to me. Another thing we have to do is to, as a government, to get our act together in terms of coordination around what the agenda is. So the fact that government does not have, despite the NDP, the NDP was criticized for lack of clarity about the way to promote growth, right? And there hasn't been much debate about that. The Planning Commission, I know from planning commissioners who said there was a task group set up after the plan was prepared to go away and improve the economic part of it, right, to get more consensus. There was contradictions between different chapters. And that didn't get buy-in from the top. Right, so as a government, we're not clear, and government has to knock heads together much better, it seems to me, to really agree on what the solution. I don't think it is about labour market reform and about privatising state enterprises. I don't think it's a neoliberal solution that's going to help us. We're a different society, right? People will not tolerate neoliberalism to a greater extent. The GEAR was a failure, It didn't do what's required. So I think it does require a social consensus among business and labour and really a willingness to compromise. All round, it has to be give and take, a real hard bargain going on, give and take, so everybody accepts some compromise in return for this collective agenda of reigniting economic growth. And I think the urban, I think I'll probably finish on the urban one, I think that is part of it, as I made that point. I think if you look at, follow the logic of the MTBS about the need for cooperation, for stimulating, leveraging private investment, coordinating public infrastructure, that case is really compelling in the case of our cities. Our cities are where people from rural areas are moving to. They see that as their future, where they're going to make livelihoods, where their children are going to be better off. This is where the private sector is the proven track record, willing to invest. These are where we have our biggest housing backlogs. These are where we have our protests, right? There's such a compelling case for a focused cities agenda, it seems to me, that, you know, it is a bit sensitive. There's no doubt about that. It's a bit sensitive. But the case is overwhelming, it seems to me, for coordination and focus and a pakisa around overcoming these bureaucratic and governance problems. You know, provinces are not support. Most provinces do not support cities. I work in Etequini, right? And KZN is basically says Durban can look after itself. It's building schools in the rural areas. It's not building hospitals and clinics and public pump-priming public investment into the places where the private sector wants to go. So that's that issue of the public-private thing. You know, we have such mistrust and misunderstanding. I agree with the minister when he says that the private sector is sitting on $600 billion. It is a global problem, but we have our distinctive South African features of that. And I think we have to have much better mutual understanding. You know, what is it that's holding up the private sector? We need to talk to them much more honestly and frankly about what's stopping them investing, and then we need to see where we can meet them halfway, right? In some of the regulatory reforms, we really need a hard-headed conversation around what will unlock that private investment, because I think that is part of the solution. A critical part of the solution is to get more private investment. We need a better understanding, more trust, and more honesty in that relationship. And at the moment, you know, it's still far apart. That is one of the things that really undermined all the pakisas, has been this mistrust between the private sector and government. And within government, you know, we don't have our act together. The spheres of government do not cooperate. I know well in the human settlements field, you know, the provinces want to build housing in a different place where the municipalities want to build housing. There are conflicts over the infrastructure spending. All right, there are systematic conflicts across spheres of government. We don't have our act together. And there was a final point I wanted to make. Okay, so VAT is part of the attractiveness is that everybody pays it. All right, so that's why it brings in a lot of tax. My simple answer to you, I think it would be administratively very complicated to give a waiver to some people with a card. You know, how do you administer? Every retail outlet would have to have two systems in place to deal with that. I like the idea, but I think a better way is a progressive, do it through the income tax system, raise the thresholds so that people, you know, are offset and then make their own spending decisions. I think so. That's just a view on that.
Let me take the question quickly on fees and make the comment, Chair, that we already have with the NSFAS approach to these, some of these conditions are already in place. So NSFAS began to implement the rule 2 years ago, which it didn't before, that if you failed a course, if you did not get a level of 60% in the course, that you would not be eligible for a repeat of the grant. And so these conditions are already there. But I think it's important to come to your question about conditions. The most important thing I think we all want to emphasize, even to the students, is that nobody will disagree with the claim that a deserving child who meets the entrance requirements to university on merit, who is poor, should be denied the opportunity. Nobody disagrees with that. What is in disagreement is that everybody should get free education. And that is, I think, a really important area of contention inside of the country. We need to have the modalities to be able to make clear, because there have been many contributions in the last while, and I think most of us would agree with this, to say that you need to have a system where the wealthy and the privileged and the rich will actually pay. You need to have a system of making those who can afford it pay. Now, this might mean rethinking simply how the subsidy system works inside of the universities, and there's a lot of practical work which needs to be done here, which is going to take, I think, a lot more discussion between people in Treasury, between economists, and between people who actually administer systems like this. Because they are, to come back to this VAT question, the administering of a system which requires you to differentiate between people of different income streams, different levels, is enormously difficult. So I've just come out of a university system, and it is absolutely clear that we are not yet in a position which is where we should be, where we are looking at every student on an individual basis, which is what we should be doing. To look at the individual needs and the individual circumstances of every student, and to make an assessment for a student on those bases. Because there may be wealthy students, and this is why the 600,000 that the minister's come up with is controversial, because it's quite high. It's quite a high cut-off point. But there are many families who have 3-4 children who are at university. And a family of three, four children earning 600,000, it's difficult to keep a student at. So there are individual circumstances here which we need an administrative system that is manageable, which you can operate with a fair degree of reliability and integrity. So in other words, you mustn't have a system where students can fiddle the system and bring you their parents' payslips, and it's a fraudulent payslip. You know, so there are lots of difficulties so there's a lot that needs to be done here to get fairness right, Chair. I'm going to ask Vijay to talk about these matches between the school system and the labour market.
To link the education, skills, and jobs. And Prof. Sodin, in the first slide, you know, and I think this is an important point, is there's always tough choices and crossroads. Choices are never simple. And in relation to those three things, there's such a conundrum for South Africa that faces, and you as the lawmakers have to make those kinds of decisions. Because if we look at the skills and jobs, and we do have a very high unemployment number. It's 8 million. And 60% of the unemployed have less than grade 12. So we have these conundrums in the economy and the society. We have high levels of unemployment, but they have low skills, less than grade 12. Then we have shortages and vacancies for the areas of those with high skills. So the challenge in terms of growing the economy, and in a world where you have mechanization, automation, digitization, and all those highly, technologies increasing, you have to create, and so you can take a job, and it can be labor intensive, or you can mechanize it, but in mechanization, you're going to lose jobs. So within this basket of things of low skill and mechanization, how do you grow the economy that is labor intensive so that people do get jobs? And the sectors that are traditionally labor intensive, agriculture, mining, Now, those sectors have contracted, and in our document that we've given there, we've shown how those sectors have contracted over this time. The big expectation in the country is that manufacturing will increase. And again, the manufacturing sector has decreased both in terms of its contribution to GDP and its and those that have and its employment. So, you know, if one's looking for boosts, it's the I guess the manufacturing sector, and in addition, I mean, the blue economy will create jobs. And if we just think about jobs as well, and while there's been a big increase in the public sector, the increase has also been, which on, you know, these are tough choices. We've had massive increase in jobs for those that are, say, refuse workers. Because on the one hand, so government is creating jobs for those with low skill, and you're giving a livelihood there. But it's but it again increases the number of people. So everything is, nothing is going to be a straightforward, and it's complex and complicated and nuanced, and how do you make the best decisions for things to work? Just in relation to some of the questions that you've asked there, are public servants qualified, and does it mean that we have this high levels of public servants? In a piece of research that we did, because you pay the skills levy, and you have within the public sector enormous numbers or enormous levels of training taking place, because we analyze the expenditure and there's high usage of that expenditure. Does training lead to better efficiencies? What has been the outcome of training? You might have personal benefits in that people might get a higher salary and get promotions. But it's difficult to look. I think it's more the anecdotal. We're saying that it has not led to better service delivery. But it's, and as far as I'm aware, it's not enough research as yet on how to quantify that. And if we also look at public servants, if we look at the whole country and the whole labor market, and all those are categorized managers, legislators, etc., only 44% have a tertiary education, so 56% don't have that education. With regard to that slide with all the numbers, the 100 to sorry. If we look at, in terms of the way they categorize people in the labor market, they do it in terms of different occupations. And the one, the highest level of occupation is managers, legislators, CEOs, etc. And the second level is professionals, say. And if you analyze the education qualification of this big group of people categorized as managers and legislators and CEOs, 44% of them have a tertiary qualification. So we would have expected higher qualifications within that. For example, the professionals, everybody that is categorized in the occupation professionals, three-quarters of them have a tertiary qualification. So just understanding the qualification levels of the workforce. With regards to that slide page 19. The methodology to get to this slide was to look at all those who are on the National Senior Certificate database and who wrote matric in 2008, and they were followed into different institutions. So the question about is it national? Yes, the answer is that it is national. And is it public or independent? It's whoever wrote the National Senior Certificate, and some people in independent schools do write that examination. And independent schools constitute about 7% of the whole of learners. The methodology was largely statistical to just track people, so we don't know the reasons why people are in there, and that would be the next success. Question about the poor successes in TVET colleges, 1 in 10 as the numbers, I think the National Treasury did this. Yes, it is a major concern about efficiencies within, there's been rapid expansion, and you have rapid expansion, quality drops, and I think the challenges of the TVET sector in terms of the students, the qualifications, the lecturers, the applied learning, and there's a multitude of challenges and that needs to be increased. But we have to do, I mean, the TVET sector in any growing economy, any industrialized economy, is a critical sector, so getting that sector right is a major challenge that Ms. Minister or Dee had, and the country faces. And I think when they had the merger from the 150 TVET colleges to the 50, and the first 5 years were just spent on governance issues and trying to get these massive places to start working. And I hope that, you know, it now can move to what happens in the and there's been massive capitalization there. The issue about responsiveness and planning, just to say also the Labour Market Intelligence Project responded to Government Outcome 5.2.2, which was to build a skills planning mechanism for the country. And so part of the research was directly that DIET had to deliver on that, and that's what we were responding to. But it is a national planning, and so we've got national results. And I think if you look at TVET colleges, for example, in addition to that, they will have to do local planning. And how does a TVET college operate in its own local ecosystem and economy, and the issue about responsiveness to the demands, if you in a particular, some TVET, I think there's 50 TVET colleges. Some of them are very successful and you have very entrepreneurial, they call them CEOs and not principals, very entrepreneurial and are able to link to the local, I mean, those colleges that are able to link to the local economy and have been very, very successful.
Okay, quickly, Nanya, from the public service and corruption and those kinds of questions, and then Dimitri can talk about these, why we're in this difficulty.
Thank you. I think the question of corruption is very relevant because if you want investment, you need a stable society in order for people to want to invest. And we have done research in the HSRC around community and service delivery protests. We haven't done a lot of research around the student protests, but in terms of service delivery protests, as well as community protests in general. We've worked with the South African Local Government Association. We just finished a study where we looked at the perceptions of municipal managers of the service protests. Then we did a project with the University of Johannesburg on perceptions of communities, and it seems as if they're missing one another completely. So the whole issue of communication, responsiveness, those kinds of things are coming up very often. Municipal managers are saying they're trying very hard, they're doing their jobs well, the communities are too demanding. The community members themselves or their leaders are saying the municipal managers are unresponsive, they don't care, they don't listen to them, they don't allow public participation from planning processes onwards. So protest is usually the last resort. There's a lot that happens before protest, which is a constitutional right, and even a lot before it becomes violent. So it is definitely not the first choice of a community, and I'm not talking about the students, it's something completely different. It's not the first choice of a community to participate in violent protest. And so we need to look at very carefully at what leads up to that. And we have quite a lot of data around where the problems lie and where the problems exist. So to some extent, and this is a long shot, but we really need to reconsider our intergovernmental relations framework, including the fiscal framework. It's complicated, it's confusing, when somebody from a community goes to speak to someone in a municipal office, they say to this person, sorry, this is a provincial competency. And that's just not good enough. You know, there's an inability to respond if there are too many blockages. And we have found in our research recently that we do need to reconsider intergovernmental relations and how they can prevent service delivery on the ground.
Great, how much do I have? Chair, how much do I have? How much time do I have? Wow. thank you for the 3 minutes, Chair. 1 minute.
Go for Dimitri.
Okay. Chair, thank you. Grateful to have the 3 minutes. I'll try and do my best. I'm one of those that believes that the VAT is a tool that is not reached its potential in terms of utilization. And it needs to be looked at. I am aware of the difficulties that have been spoken. We disagree in the HSRC as well, don't worry. But I think it's something that we need to look at. Because it relates to the question that the honorable member raised, what caused all this? And at the risk of being seen as a nanny state, the VAT has a role to play, as we started it with sugar. Now, what went wrong? Well, evolution went wrong, or we went wrong in our evolution. You can't get away from the fact that you have to eat. You won't last more than 40 days if you don't. But you don't eat to survive, you eat for pleasure. And some of us have a greater pleasure affinity than others. I will add 15 seconds. And then, of course, you've got those that are the so-called well-to-do of today, the fortunate ones, and they like food. So they eat. We overeat as a nation. That's why where we are. And that's why we need new tools and we need new interventions, like the Honourable Member said, started, she feels better. How do you get that to the people? So that is the one arm of the problem as it evolved. We eat too much because we have more money. Yeah? But then what happens to the poor? Well, they're worse off. It's expensive to be poor. Because they also overeat, but they overeat energy-dense stuff. And that's why they become obese. And believe me, the disease profile of the country is not any different between the well-to-do and the not-so-well-to-do, except the not-so-well-to-do can't do very much, so they have more complications and they suffer greater from ill health. And then the third component, Chair, 10 seconds. The third component. We don't look after our children properly. And essentially, when they don't grow properly at a young age, we're talking about 2 or 3 years of age, they become so-called stunted. In other words, their growth is impaired. Now, when you have or follow those children up, they're as much as 7 times more likely to develop obesity. So we have an inheritance coming with us because stunting was very high in our country, still very high, it's about 22-23%. So that is also a predisposing factor. And so you see a lot of people that are short and obese. And in a way, it makes sense, although we don't understand it, you know. If you cannot grow that way, which is the normal way, then you grow only the other way, this way. It's as simple as that. Thank you, sir.
No, thank you, Chair. I don't know if you're a doctor. I want to thank you very much because my father spent a lot of time in jail and in exile, so I was not well looked after. So that is why I grow this way. So that is why when we debate and say the effect of apartheid, I hope you'll understand, my friend. I'm an example of that. So the other thing is, this Wall Street inflicted pain that we are suffering from ourselves in Europe, we are not the cause. But you know, they have spread this thing to us, and they have got some medicines for themselves. I understand their economy is growing. I think there is some unfairness, you know, with this America. That is why I'm not worried who is president. I always think of the 2008 meltdown when I think of them. And, you know, you remember during that period, Queen Elizabeth of England actually asked, where were the economists? Not even one of them could predict. So I am very skeptical when we talk about development and we talk about these intellectuals called economists. I don't know whether they are not going to take us to another recession again after the 2008. So I just want to hear from you whether when you are talking about education, you are referring to economists and bankers. I'm scared of those people because my understanding, you know, I've read a lot about that. Even Professor Joseph Stiglitz, the most cited economist of our time, is saying that. And even Professor Ajun Chang of Cambridge is saying that. These economists, there's a lot of trouble about them.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is just on a follow up on the health one in terms of this burdening diseases and stuff. In comparison with all of the other provinces, was comparison done to all of the provinces? And is it more higher, perhaps, maybe in the Eastern Cape areas, or let me say in your rural areas as opposed to your other areas like your Western Cape and so forth, like comparison in that regard? And then as well on the rural development, I fully agree with you, Prof, on the saying that, like, sort of the shift they've been tend to have been sent now to rural development and sorting the rural areas out and building of schools and facilities in these rural areas. But we sort of have tend to forget about your urban areas and so forth. So I think in that regard, one have to look at it like more work needs to be done to sort of shift the paradigm and say, look, all of the individuals from your rural areas are coming anyway now to urban areas to come and work. So facilities needs to be built and keep up to date because of this, how can I say, I don't know how, which word can I use, but shifting of inter-province moving and so forth. And then, because some of these facilities do tend to be white elephants in your rural areas, or only you have in some instances that schools are not or clinics are not used because of that nature. So I would definitely would like to see more work done and maybe see the shift in the years to come in that perspective. And then also on the protest as well and stuff, I would like to also see maybe on a later stage the one of the free fees protests that you work on then. Obviously, like as policy makers and policy influencers, we all are at different stages in our debates and how we see it going forward. Free education. So one would like to see also some work in that perspective. And then prior to students doing the protest, what could have influenced the violence that we have seen, the burning of institutions and so forth. And then also the part of the police in all of this in protest. And the police response to community members, whether workers, whether you know, in terms of and the students as well. So one would like to see that as well work done on that, and then the research documents that you have talked about earlier on, if you don't mind, or where if you can just make available to the secretaries where one can find those research documents and so forth. And then also on the school one, I just like to find out, like, in terms of, was any work done in terms of the food, the school feeding program as well? Because when I've seen there's now numerous incidents that are happening over the last past couple of years or months or so, that you know, students falling sick and ill, and the management of such programs as well, and was work done in terms of in that as well to just safeguard and sort of protect. You don't want to do something good, by the end of the day it's going to harm and you will face with debts on a later stage on this school feeding programs. And also on the TVET colleges, the last one, Chair, I promise I won't keep them for the whole day. The last one, Chair, on the TVET colleges as well. How many of these TVET colleges, like, are sort of still, how can I say it, on governments, you know, TVETs, like, okay, that is accountable to government or sort of financially reliant on government, and how many are private? Because I can recall an incident in the one in George. There was a one in George in Southern Cape, whereby learners had to took to the streets, also in protest, also of their frustrations in terms of their employment and things like that. And so, in terms of how we're going to curve this fly by night TVs that are just standing up and in some instances also rob parents from or students from their fees. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you, Honourable
Member Manana.
Oh, sorry, Chair. Can I just have the last one on the energy one? Sorry, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, Honorable Manan. Yeah, it's a last one, a very important one as well, on the energy one. You have a graph there that have showed the low, medium, high in terms of priority. But what I also like to see, if you have done any work in terms of the pricing as well, like in terms of high priority, it doesn't matter as long as it's cheaper and things like that, nuclear, coal, which one is cheaper for the country and most suitable for our needs as well, because we have seen we are going into a nuclear deal that is over going to cost the country over R1 trillion, and we've seen reports that we don't basically have the thing better. And you hear many stories that it's going to be paid off over a number of years and stuff like that. But one just want to see, is it really going to be affordable, or is it really going to be feasible for the country to go into a nuclear deal rather than to go into renewables, which is high on your list of your of priority of where you have done your research. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member Manana.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. Prof, I'm satisfied with your answer. And you have indicated to us that we are also the problem. But where from now? Because we need to correct the situation. We cannot say let's leave it as it is, must continue. And you have indicated that this issue of health problems can collapse the country. And we need to do things differently and urgently so. Not tomorrow, but now. Thank you.
All right, from me, Prof. Well, in getting the private sector on board, I would like to refer to the MTBPS, where it states that the science councils are not effective in partnering with the private sector. What's your take on this one? And then secondly, the MTBPS process has made, in our involvement in the MTBP process, we've made observations of reluctance from business groups such as the Black Management Forum, Business Unity, South Africa, Business Leadership South Africa, and others to participate. Yet, issues of spending on small business skills development and infrastructure affect them directly. What do you think is the challenge? Where is the challenge? And how can we make sure that, because it's in public participation, and also in terms of your, I think it's your, it's a King 3, they are stakeholders. And now the latest, you've seen your King 4 report. They are key stakeholders. Why is it the case, in your view, that they don't want to participate in these processes and assist? All right. Over to you.
Do they help on the what do we do? That was the question.
Thank you, Grant. What do we do? That was the question.
My challenge on this one, the person who asked the question is not here.
It's not here, okay.
Yeah, so let's start with those questions that the people who asked are here, and then we end up with that one, because we don't want her to come and say, can you please repeat yourself? Thank you.
Can we do the rural urban one?
Should I start with the economic one? The first one, yeah. I mean, I think it's no doubt it's a very tough world out there, right? and that it's increasingly competitive. And also with we've seen with Brexit and other Donald Trump and other developments, increasing protectionism around the world. Okay, so it's going to get tougher for us, more competition for our exports, more tariffs possibly on our exports. So life is going to get more difficult. And there's a lot of things outside our control. So when you talk about Wall Street, et cetera, there's no doubt about that, that you know, a lot of it is outside our control, and we, you know, there's a limit to what we can do. However, there are also many things in our own control where we shoot ourselves in the foot and where we could pull ourselves together better, right? So some of our destiny is in our hands. And it's about the quality of spending. We've heard that education story. It's repeated in other parts of government as well. The quality of spending, the mismanagement of some of our, particularly the state entities, it's linked to the quality of spending, mismanagement. You know, we need to sort some of these things out. There has to be consequences for, you know, some of the problems that have been exposed, most recently last week as well. You know, there has to be consequences when people are stealing public money, you know. And so, I mean, it's a fact of life that we are entering a new period now when there's going to be tougher controls on state spending. That's going to force us to improve much of what we do. I hope that will be used in a constructive way. There's a saying, you know, don't let a crisis go to waste. You use the opportunity of constraints to really ask tough questions of ourselves. Which areas of spending are more important and which areas of spending are less important, you know, to prioritize. So I think that austerity will force us to make efficiencies and to ask tough questions, and hopefully there'll be a positive thing to come out of it in a sense of greater sense of direction, greater coherence across government. Let me move to the rural-urban thing. I think, you know, it's not an either-or. We need to sustain. We talk about inclusive growth. It's, you know, ensuring that people, that nobody, we're all in this together. We have to support rural development. We can do more in agriculture, in rural tourism. A lot of the renewable energy you mentioned, many of those projects on rural areas need to capture the benefits of that investment as far as possible for jobs and livelihoods and so on. There's no doubt about that, but I think the best bet in terms of public investment in infrastructure and so on is around our cities, and it's about connecting the two. So people, you know, the road infrastructure, the telecommunications infrastructure, we have a single integrated country. It's not just exclusively focused on the urban. Let me touch on the final point about the business, the private sector chair that you were raising at the end. I think the simple answer, it's a complicated question again, these questions are all complicated. Why doesn't the private sector come to the party? I think, in a nutshell, they don't trust the government. They don't trust the government will deliver on its promises. They're suspicious about implementation. I mean, this experience with the last 6 months of the Minister of Finance going to New York and trying to mobilize different stakeholders is quite an interesting one, and I think there's a lot to learn from that experience. And I think the sense is government needs to, you know, decide on its priorities and then deliver, follow through on those priorities. I think, you know, we need consistency across government. We need coherence. We need trust of different stakeholders and honesty and real negotiation and partnership, recognizing the tough realities of the situation, it seems to me. Less rhetoric, less talk shops, and more seriousness about confronting the big challenges we face.
Okay, so we take the health. DJ will talk about the TVET. I'll talk about the burning, and Mark talk about the science council.
Yeah.
Sorry, and
he
will talk about the energy, please.
Yeah. I'll be as brief as I can. What do we do? This is a multi-dimensional problem, and it has no silver bullets. In essence, we have to eat less, and that takes education, and we have to be more active. and I'll come to the urbanization issue just now. But the points of intervention which makes health so expensive is that you have to intervene at the school level. That's the comment about the school. You have to intervene at the worker level because we spend a lot of time at work. You have to intervene at the community level. And most importantly, or equally importantly, we have to intervene at the home, in the home itself. Put together, you're talking about environment. People don't exercise these days, be it at school or be it outside, it's not safe. Or the curriculum has changed. So we have to start looking at all these things with the aim in mind to actually increase energy expenditure in order to reduce weight and eat less of the right foods. And this is where the VAT issue comes in again. It is more expensive to have to buy healthy foods than it is to buy the starchy, energy-dense foods. And that is something that we will have to look at as well. So the environment itself has to change. At the moment, what is happening? Everybody is coming to the cities. Cities is very, very, very prominent, and we've been talking about it. But as a last comment, maybe I think we ought to think the Swedish way, that maybe we should start urbanizing our rural areas in order to reduce the burden on the cities. You can't burden the cities forever after. So we have to be looking far in the future about solutions, because people come to the urban cities not because they necessarily like it. There are a lot of reasons, yeah. But maybe a lot of them will prefer to stay where they are if they have the conveniences, so-called, that you'll find in an urbanized area. So maybe the reverse has not been raised, and I think it should be discussed. Thank you.
Just in response to the two questions, I know that our CEO will address the burning issue of the fees must fall. We have done some initial research, but it's certainly not enough to reach any conclusion that I can share with you. We're trying to move into the area of doing action research. For example, going to Vuwani and finding out what happened there in terms of the demarcation issues before the elections. But this is quite intensive and also funding intensive. So please keep us in mind with the DST. But the issue of police responses came up in community and service delivery protests as well. We don't have well-trained public police. And the responses are excessive, and there's not enough negotiation and a better approach to the anger of people that we should see as justified. You know, we can't just dismiss the anger of our people. With regards to energy, you know, what our priorities are, you know, renewables, there have been so many developments throughout the world in terms of renewables, in particular wind and solar. And we can learn a lot from Germany there, that it's not necessarily a very expensive way to go. And the issue of wave energy, ocean energy, is also something that we need to consider. It may be more expensive, but countries like the UAE are developing technologies that are bringing down the price of renewables, and in particular ocean and wave energy. So there's lots of places to go, lots of places to look at. I think nuclear is probably the more expensive option, but you know, Treasury says that we need to do costing, right? I don't know if they've done this costing. It would be interesting to see, because I know that the new developments around, we have to have socioeconomic impact assessments on policy and legislation, because I work a little bit with the Department of Health on the NHI, and that's precisely what they're asking us to do, to look at the socioeconomic impact of this policy and legislation. We have to do the same here as well.
with respect to the two questions on education and the school nutritional program, the National School Nutrition Program, we haven't done any work, but I do know there's been some impact assessments done, and it's a very important part of the conditional grants that are made to provinces, and I can send reports from, but it's, we haven't done that. I just want to add on that, though, that with regard to nutrition, the Department of Science and Technology with the CSIR started a pilot project in the Eastern Cape, in the Kofumbaba area, and the key idea was that how do we look at what used to be the traditional foods, what people used to have, and the micronutrients that are present in beet and spinach and informa, all the traditional food, and, you know, with different lifestyles, Prof. Dimitri would say, we're missing out on all those micronutrients, and they're trying to extract that micronutrients, and then they prepared a breakfast drink to give to the children every morning when they came in. And so they're also in the process of trying to evaluate the impact on the health of people. So those are, you know, very innovative pieces of work that's being done there. With regard to the TVET colleges, the majority of the colleges are public. We have sent a link for the skills supply and demand report, and I don't know whether the Darren has sent that to you, but we've done and there's one chapter on skills supply which comprehensively describes the TVET and the university sector and public and private. What I want to say about the private, it's very small, as I said, but they've been very good in terms of short-term responsive courses. You know, a good experiment to do is that if you have you need a plumber at home and you get somebody to come, or the geyser blows up, and I always ask those people that come, you know, what was your training, where did you get it, and how long? And it's generally a 3-month training at a private college, which the individual would have paid themselves. And they get into these jobs. And one of the recommendations we've made to DHET is that public colleges must be far more responsive with short courses. They're very hooked onto the long 2-year, but it's not the ones that you finish off and you can get into the labor market, trained to become the geyser specialist or whatever it is. But privates have done well in that. And just the last point on TVET colleges and private sector. You know, we did a trip with DHET to Germany and to Australia, and it's amazing that the TVET sector in both countries is driven by the private sector. The TVET sector is where, you know, the councils, because there's very strong relationships with these TVET sectors. Of course, it's not that they're doing it for the love of it, but they need those people to come and work in their sectors. And it is true that even when we have all our workshops around skills planning, and we do send invitations to all the business unity, to the private sector. And the big gap is that we're talking about skills for the economy, and the people that are in that economy who can best evaluate, they don't attend. So trying to bridge that gap will be critical.
Okay, can I just make two comments quickly, Chair? So the first one is about these burnings. It's a major issue around which we need to do a whole lot more empirical work. And so, as Professor Nanya has indicated, we've sent a team to Vuwani to try and understand what's going on. I mean, the fact that, call it 27 or 31 schools have been burned down by must be some people who would have gone through the process of schooling is something that we must understand. Is there so much alienation from the process of education in the country that people see no value in these institutions? Is that the issue, that they see no value in these institutions? So we need to understand that. And when it comes to the students at the moment, we need to do a whole lot more work. And I want to make simply one point about all of this. It's not all of the students. And the students there are many, many, if you like, interest groups. I'm not going to use the word factions. There are very, very many groupings within the students. And the number or proportion of students who have been responsible for these burnings constitutes a really small number. And we now need to be able to empirically demonstrate that, and we should be able to get to that quite quickly. And once we understand that, I think we will understand that those students bring a whole lot of social factors to that particular act of burning. There are lots of things going on in those students' lives as they make those decisions about what it is that they will do. Lots of things, including personal tragedy in their lives. And so we need to understand that a whole lot better. Chair, your question about science councils is a really important one. So we're the Human Sciences Council is a very different council to the CSR, the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. In the PFMA, they're a Schedule 3B council. We're a Schedule 3A council. They can make profits. We can't make profits. We're not allowed to generate income. And this has a major impact on the kinds of relationships that we have with the private sector. So we would go to the private sector in a very different relationship. We and other science councils, the Agricultural Research Council, the Medical Research Council, SANSA, I mean, they would go to the privates in a very different relationship to the CSIR. We generally wait for private sector colleagues to come to us to help them with one or other issue that they may have. Or we would make an approach to them to give us support for big public-minded research that we need to do. But we're not in an easy relationship with the private sector. It's a very different relationship that we have with government. With government, there is the question of what we call public good. Public interest research. With private sector companies, there is very different kinds of interests that they would come to us with, and that would make it very often very difficult, because we often would not be in agreement with some of the things that they may ask us to be looking at. But the critical point to make, just for information, Chair, is that our Ministry is in the process of developing a new white paper for science and technology innovation. And that white paper is going to be presented to Parliament in around about October, November next year. And a key issue in that white paper is the cooperation between the public sector, the private sector, and the higher education, the universities, in other words, and the science councils. And there's a whole lot of concern and discussion right now that those sectors are not talking with one another about the kinds of innovations that are required to be able to take us to another level of, if you like, growing the economy, engaging with these big problems that we have got in the country, and that you cannot leave those issues to just government alone. You can't leave them to the university. There has to be collaboration and cooperation in thinking about these innovations. So innovation is the big, big issue for the next period. So when we think about how we come to grow the economy beyond the 3%, how we come to deal with all of these problems, innovation is an issue. And it's not about silver bullets. It's not about great discoveries. It's also about behavior. It's about, and this is why what Professor Labadoris was talking about is absolutely crucial. How do we change our behavior around a whole lot of things which compound the problems which we find ourselves having to confront every day. And what's the role, if you like, of government in relation to that? What's the role of the knowledge-producing community like us in the science councils? And what's the role of the private sector? Does the private sector have any responsibility in that? And we want to say yes, actually they do. But it can't be on their terms. I mean, they've got to come into a discussion here with all of us about what a reasonable consensus is that we as a society would wish to want for ourselves. What kind of reasonable future is it that we could be committing ourselves going forward, you know, as a society? Thank you very much, Jane.
Indeed, we've had a very interesting engagement. Now, Prof, I just want to find out, would you like to make a closing statement, because it does look to have another follow-up question?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to humbly request the Commission if they cannot look at that issue that I raised about the money's capital flight, the impact of capital flight in our country specifically.
Okay. All right. I'm sure you are you expecting a response now or a written? Okay. All right. I'm sure you're comfortable with that one, Prof?
Not comfortable.
May not all have all the expertise in Ivan's unit to be able to do that straight off. But we will go and generate an answer. We will come back with a response, Chair.
All right.
Sorry, Chair. Just in that perspective, I know that Davis Tax Commission also did some work on that, because I remember sometime a while ago, I think last year, we also developed a paper as EFF and we went and presented for them at the Davis Tax Commission. So I know they have done substantive work on that illicit flows and illicit trades and things like that. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Now, do you have a proposal? Because I know you said you presented to them a paper. So do you have a proposal for this committee?
I can get our
way forward.
No, I say we can also do it with the Davis Tax Commission on illicit flows, because I know they have done extensive work on it as well.
Okay, so we can get their report.
Yes, as well, Chair. Thanks.
Okay. No, that's fine. Thanks for your input. At least we now know where this other information is.
The Davis Commission or any other commission, it does not take away my request. It does not take away my request. My request stands that they should look at it, whether they will tell us they got it from Davis Commission and others. Because, you see, these are specialists. They don't just look at Davis Commission only. They apply other things. So if they can just look at that, I'm not in a hurry. And, you know, Professor Churok was my lecturer in the political economy a political economy course which we did with the University of Cape Town. I know what we can get. We can get much more than that.
Okay. Honorable members, but that was my understanding. That's why I said the other information. There's this other. So you know, in reading, you read and look at things from different perspectives, different angles, and then I'm sure you can then opinionate, you know, moving from an informed position. So that was my understanding. But thank you so much for all your understanding. And Honorable Member Madope, do you want to share with us? Because I can hear there's an input that you want to make. Honorable Member Madope.
Thanks, Chair. No, Chair, I don't think she thinks that there is a disagreement around the issue of Honorable Shobisitole.
Okay.
I'm saying that there is no disagreement. What he's saying is important for us to get that report. But what she's saying, she's requesting the Human Research Council.
All right.
To,
no,
to
that's
do.
Fine. Thank you so much. Now, Prof, would you like to make a closing statement?
No, except to say really thank you, Chair, for having us here and for over 3.5 hours, close to 4, engaging in, I think, a really valuable set of conversations and discussions. The issues are really important. I want to respond to this question about how much of this capacity inside of the HSRC comes into the public space. And it's a really important question, Chair. We try and do that. We have a magazine which is called the Human Sciences Review, which puts together a short, accessible digest on these issues, and we'd be very happy to circulate it even more widely than we do. It's part of our public science obligation. But if you have any suggestions, ideas about issues that you think should appear in that journal, and for us to be taking up, we'd be very happy to respond. Because I do think, Chair, that a major issue in the country that we have at the moment now is about what kind of future that we want. And in resolving, you know, that question, the universities and the science councils aren't only spaces for, if you like, providing young people, providing professors with the opportunity to earn an income. They are actually putting information at the disposal of all of us that we should be thinking about much more in the public domain. So we have a very active, and this will be my last comment, we have a very active public commentary environment. You know, people speak very freely often, and, you know, our radio and social media are very open and active, but they aren't sufficiently enriched. And I don't say this in a patronizing way at all, Chair. They aren't sufficiently enriched with the best thinking that is available on key questions when those questions arise as opportunities for debate. I mean, you take this fees question, for example. You know, the fees question requires a really clear technical response, you know, right now about what is possible. What is possible? And we've been unable to get that clarity of information out into the public domain sufficient for it to be able to influence the way in which that discussion takes place. So we play a really important role, Chair, and we are quite happy to, with your provocation and with your stimulation and your support, to fulfill the mandate that we are required to fulfill in terms of our statute. I really appreciate the time that we spent here, Chair, and our thanks to you.
Professor and your team and all the guests that are present here, I'm sure we are sharing the same sentiments when I say, indeed, we've spent 3.5 hours, and in these 3.5 hours, we've had a meaningful, fruitful, and constructive engagement that has provided the members with a lot of options in terms of recommendations to the House. A lot of options. In other words, it was an enriching experience engaging with your good selves. And thank you so much. I really would like to thank all of you for your full participation in this critical briefing from the Human Science Research Council on the 2016 Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement. Very detailed and comprehensive presentation, which is highly appreciated. I will just highlight some of the key issues that came from our engagements. I promise you I'm going to be very short on this one, I can see, and everybody's tired now. Well, the honorable members have come up very strong and expressed their concern with regard to fiscal sustainability, which includes our debt levels, revenue measures in the budget, how to raise economic growth, inclusive economic growth, the state of our health facilities. I'm telling you here, we all have witnessed how Professor Dimitri, expressed himself passionately about this health issue and how if we can move from consumption to investment also in our health, that can assist, you know, in taking this nation to new heights. He was very passionate about it. And he kept on coming on it, you know, on the way we eat and our lifestyle. Okay, no, that's fine. The health profile of South Africans. Still talking about observations by honorable members and their concerns in our engagement. Educational outcomes, which are not so pleasing, and the school dropouts, which are disturbing. Matching skills to jobs, and it's a scarce skills that could be assisting, that came from the emphasis on the importance of TVET colleges so that it can they can produce the scarce skills that we need to grow the economy. Challenges in state coordination and others. All these challenges seriously undermine the NDP's developmental and transformation objectives. We indeed need to work together to address these challenges. Well, to Human Science Research Council, we would like to appeal to you to keep the committee. We've actually, you know, we've benefited from your well-researched presentation. And from that's why I'm going to appeal to you to always keep this committee in the loop on some of the major research milestones that you reach in socio-economic issues so that it enriches our engagement also with the departments in trying to measure their performance and making sure that they balance their performance with compliance and create a conducive environment for economic growth but also for investor confidence. Now, as it's important we keep these ongoing discussions alive, as we seek options and ideas for transformative budget allocations. So thanks to the Human Science Research Council, your inputs are most valued and will assist us as we finalize our report, meaning that we will consider the recommendations that you've put across, and after carefully applying our minds, I'm sure we should be able to use those recommendations in our report. So thank you so much. Indeed, it has been a fruitful and constructive engagement. And honorable members, I think the meeting between ourselves and the Human Research... Human Science Research Council, I think has come to an end. Thank you so much, and we wish you travel safe. Thank you. But then, honorable members, in terms of our agenda, there's only one last item. It's just for, we want to report back to you. It's going to be very short. And then there's correspondence from the higher office. Thank you so much, Prof. Okay. So, Honorable Members, I'm sure you are able to exchange your cards also with Professor. As he gives you his cards, you also give him your cards. That's how it works. It cannot be a one-way traffic. You must exchange. Okay, thank you so much. Okay. Shall we quickly get a feedback on appearance before the Commission of Inquiry into Higher Education and Training? Yes, sir?
Can I please address you for 30 seconds on the program? 30 seconds, I promise. This program.
Okay, fine.
We got it yesterday. Yeah. I've just got three issues that I want to raise quickly. Yeah. No, I'm not asking Chair, sorry. Okay, Chair, sorry for being rude, but you would be able to follow what I'm saying without the program. Yes, please. If you... Okay. Yeah, thank you. Chair, okay, thank you. Tomorrow, the program is... 12:30 to 1500. Can I request either we complete at 2 o'clock, because myself and Mr. McLaughlin won't be available after 2 o'clock. So, because there's a house sitting starting at 2 o'clock. It will be easier, Chair, you did indicate that there will be a slot where we could discuss the proposals. We won't be ready for the proposals tomorrow. But having said that, there might not be, don't look so worried, there might not, we don't anticipate that we'll have too many proposals or change to the Division of Revenue Amendments. So we then would like to request that we deal with that on Monday. If anything, there won't be more than five. Monday, yes. Yes, Chair. Yes. Okay, Chair.
Yeah, you're right. And you must remember, procedurally, after you have tabled, if we all agree, you must then do public participation, go for public participation, and that's the amendment. On the amendment, we can also get the discussion of the time. Yeah, it's too late.
Okay, all right.
Let's try and have some. Okay.
Okay, noted, Chair. Okay, that's fine. Yes. Okay. Yes. Chair, I need to be protected from the after Aussie, so. Yeah, I don't mean to delay. Can you allow me, please? And then the second request is for to provide any possible proposals with regards to the Appropriations Adjustment Bill on the 29th, Tuesday the 29th of November, if possible. Yes, Tuesday the 29th, yes. That we, I'm sorry to do this here, to provide any proposals with regards to the appropriations adjustment on Tuesday the 29th. On date, we've got a hearing with identified departments, and the consideration of the report is on the next day, which is the Wednesday. Yeah. Sorry to do it. But...
Your office.
have serious issues, so you need to answer. You guys have serious issues, so you need to answer.
No,
no,
I want to go for answering.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand.
What is
the logic of wanting to bring this thing to just people in your touch? There's a trick. So I think let's proceed. Maybe we can allow, if we want to shift, but depending on whether members agree with it, we can shift to the 24th, but not to the
29th.
Okay. Can we get that in writing? It's a consideration, Chair. Thank you. Can I just? It's not the trick. I just want to go back to the division of revenue. You see, the briefing is tomorrow, and then the public hearings is on Friday. So there might be something that comes out in the briefing as well as the public hearings, and that's the reason for the request to make any proposals for Monday. That's the reason. Sorry to interrupt. Can we think about it? Obviously, I understand that you're at a disadvantage. We can finalize it tomorrow, if that's okay. Okay.
So I think this is the last time we changed the rules. Every Sunday we change so many times. Okay.
It shows how active we are, Chair.
Yeah, as long as we are.
Thanks so much, Chairperson. Quick feedback. The committee did allow us to go and make a presentation to the Fees Commission on the understanding that it would be a sharing of information. We did get to the commission, but they did insist that unfortunately that's to take the format of a subpoena. And based on that, the presentation was not done because it would have required the swearing in and so on. And that, in our view, and the advice we got from the legal advisor at the time, was that it violates the principle of a cooperative governance. And we left the presentation with them, though, and we came back, and that's the end of it. Thank you.
In the fourth term, starting from the 11th of October, no changes will be allowed. Ne? But also, what the chairperson spoke about was, if, say, we go, like for instance, we went to Bloemfontein. Now, if members then, when we're in Bloemfontein, they change their minds and they go. They said that thing is a wasteful expenditure because they can't retrieve, they can't get the money back. So we've got to carefully apply our minds before we leave here on who is going, and if members go and attend, whatever, it can be a site visit or a workshop, or a member must stay there until the end of this thing. I think it's, let's be honest, it's a fair request from members so that we avoid this wasteful expenditure and fruitless expenditure. So it's a new move. So if we all go, we stay there until the end of this thing. Otherwise, a person must decide before going not to go. It's not me. I thought I should just make members aware of this correspondence so that we all move from the same way. Yes, ma'am.
Thanks, Chair. I don't have any issues with the correspondence, but I would also just like, before we go as well on these trips and things like that, can we just get the programs and travel things on time? Because I remember on the APEC one, it was a struggle to get the travel arrangements and things, your itinerary on time. We practically get it the Saturday late, the evening and so forth prior to us traveling the Sunday. And also on the courses, because when we got there, like, it was not the apex thing that we were looking forward to, or it didn't have the same impact. It's the same AG reports that we are getting here in Parliament, the same Chief of Procurement reports that we are getting here in Parliament, and you are using a day to travel all up and down. So when we are going to these workshops and training or oversight things, let us just check the program beforehand and see if it's really feasible for us to go, because we could have done community work and on those weeks and days that we were there in Bloemfontein, and you know. So I think I agree with the proposal, it's a fair one and so forth, but just would also emphasis that we have to check on this typical workshops that we are going on. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, I think it's a fair comment. But unfortunately, the logistics person is not here. Mm. I don't know if you've seen that. I don't know what exactly they're doing when they're not here. Because, for instance, this was for her so that she gets it directly. She's off sick. Okay, no one told me. So, you see. So that they can know. Honestly speaking, I also had the same problem. Mm. But then, okay, we'll call her and then address her so that in future, they must... Just like we had committed ourselves to working professionally, they must also be professional. We get this thing before we even go, ne? And then you decide whether you want to go or not. Because the invitation said something else. When we got there, we did not get the benefit of, you know, going there. So in other words, we can easily say there was no value for money. Okay, Honourable Member Shopestole.
I just want to say humbly, Chairperson, that I benefited a lot. I have listened to all of them. I have analyzed. If you like, I can give you a one-hour workshop on what I gained on that day. Serious. For instance, Temba Godi's input, you would not normally have it here. And it was very important.
Okay, but I'm sure we get the underlying message. Né? Some people had to come back because they felt they could have used their time better somewhere else. And let's be honest, we all look at the same thing from different angles. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure we'll accommodate everybody's view within this context. Mm-hmm. But thanks, Dr. Madope.
No,
are you helping us to close?
Yeah, Chair, I think we can close. But as the colleagues are saying, in future we must look at the program.
Before?
The second day we're having nothing to do, and on the last day it's something that we have something to do, you know. Even the scheduling of the program, it was not assisting us, because if they did this trip on the last day, it will allow other members that does not go to the trip that were interested in the inputs, you know, the presentations in the conference. Yes, it is true that the information was available, but the structuring of that program.
Okay. No, that's fine. Thank you so much. Honourable members, we have come to the end of the meeting, and thanks for your participation.
Thank you, Chairperson. I like your meeting.